My head is really tight.
I'm going to put mine here.
It's probably tight enough to, like, wedge it in.
Pardon?
There we go.
Like, it's like a shit mining lamp.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, what those fish with the...
Yes.
Anglerfish.
Yeah.
Anglerfish? Slightly, you lean very close to the prey.
A slightly over-designed RPG goblin.
Nice. How dare you.
Hello and welcome to episode
one. Oh, I didn't last long.
Hello and welcome to episode 164 of the Creighton Crowbar, a terrifying Halloween episode almost a full week after Halloween.
Woo!
By the unquiet spirit. Almost a full week after Halloween by the time you actually listen to this, but we're recording it on November the 1st, a full day after Halloween. My name is Christopher Thurston. No way is my full name. My spooky full name. And today I'm joined by Philippa War.
The ghost thereof.
The ghost of Philippa War. The eerie doppelganger of Thomas Francis.
Yes, that's me.
And a strange recurring apparition, returning guest... Jack DeKeet.
I was younger 2 years ago.
Terrifying.
Was it 2 years ago that we had it?
God, I reckon so.
That's like a four-word horror story.
I was younger 2 years ago.
Yeah. Even though it's five words.
That's the most horrific part.
Yeah.
We are sat here in the dark for some reason, illuminated only by tiny little novelty Halloween candles and some pumpkin lights Pip found. You can't appreciate this at all. Bought. Because this is a podcast. And it's also really hard to take photos of.
We haven't thought this through.
No.
Close thine eyes.
None of it.
Close your eyes and imagine the scene. By the time you listen to this, it will be BlizzCon. And there'll probably be all sorts of news that we'll talk about next week, but can only guess at now. One of those bits of news that we can almost certainly guess at, because it is totally fucking tiresomely obvious at this point, is that there will be a new Overwatch hero announced at the culmination of a month-spanning ARG and multiple leaks with pictures of the character they're about to announce.
I don't think I've seen the pictures, actually.
Oh, really?
Really? Of purple. Sombra.
She's purple.
She's purple. She's got like a sort of... like a Overwatch take on a William Gibson protagonist.
Mm.
Cyberpunk purple hair.
Oh.
Sort of an undercut
lady. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, cool. She's got really the latest leak today with a picture of the character that they're not claiming they're going to release. she has extremely bright trousers.
Ah, nice.
Implying,
That's her ultimate. Implying what? Her trousers get brighter and brighter.
So, so she gets matte white flashbang.
Yeah.
So this is going to finally happen, and the game's going to finally get a new character. Who cares? Do you care?
So I just got confused because this was teased before Anna came out, and then Anna came out, and I just thought, I guess Sombra wasn't her name.
Yeah, I thought maybe they'd renamed.
Oh, yeah, I also thought that as well, yeah.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. But no, apparently it is a different character who is a sort of evil hacker woman.
And they've been doing like a countdown that was going off for months, and then when it ticked over, nothing was revealed, really. It just kind of... like something else.
It was a thing another stage that turned out to be a particular, I think it was a Visioneer cipher thing that then took you to a particular door in a level so that you could like find the... I don't care.
Well, that sounds like... The thing I heard that was that the ARG followers were disappointed, but that sounds like something the ARG followers would like, is like a, you know... something in-game, like an extra...
Yeah, so, like, as far as I can understand, the disappointment sort of stems from the fact that there was a load of really cool... Did we say ARG? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I've always said ARG.
Oh, I've always said ARG.
Are we talking about
well.
ARG? I was like, well, those guys unhappy, I guess, but
I've always said ARG.
Okay, yeah. I'm the only one who says ARG, then.
ARG.
Yeah.
Okay, so, like, the ARG people...
It's an ARG for noted FUPS Overwatch.
Multiplayer FUPS.
Yeah.
They seem to be super happy about the fact that, like... Blizzard are really good at putting interesting ARG stuff into their games themselves. You know, like weird compass directions that lead you around maps when you view something strange in the skybox, or if you conceptualize how a map would look from above, you can get a sense of where a door might be or whatever. And there was a lot of really cool stuff leading up to this. And then past a certain point, they basically just went like, there's just a website with a percentage bar that's going up. And it's going to hit 100% on November the 1st. And that's it.
And if you look at the source code for the website, yeah, it'll say
something in Spanish.
Sombra.
Yeah. And so everybody kind of went like, oh, well, okay, I guess we're just watching the progress bar now.
It's funny because it feels like this is the ARG that's almost killed ARGs. And it's solely because it was too much spoiled ahead of time.
Well,
like, it got confused because they'd heard that, I think in an interview, I think it was Jeff Kaplan said, like, when asked about what's coming next for Overwatch, he sort of tried to start the ball rolling by going, like, well, listen out for the name Sombra. And then they started to tease it in one of the maps when they got an update. There's like a little dossier on a table that says Sombra on it if you go looking for it. And people expected it to show up in some of the short movies they were doing. And then someone found an IGN preview or a GameSpot video preview of the game from like a year earlier, where in the distance, in a bit of B-roll shot in Blizzard's offices, in the distance you can see an animator working on what is clearly a sniper scope. So then everyone decided, Sombra is a sniper, and that turned out to be Anna. And then Anna came out, and I think, as I did, you know, people thought, that's Sombra, and then that wasn't Sombra either. People knew there was going to be a character called this. But that progress of understanding was completely out of step with what Blizzard themselves were revealing. Because by the time people had progressed to, we think the character's done this, and we think she's affiliated with this, and she's going to come out about now, they'd progressed to, what if we told you her name was Sombra?
Yeah.
And it doesn't work at all.
I don't know. I feel like it's been going on for so long that the only way that they can rescue this is to never release the character and have this just be the ARG that lasts for the entire lifespan of the game and just like constantly be teasing it and just like in 10 years' time still be saying, her name is Sombra.
That's become the Half-Life 3 of Overwatch characters.
It's also got to be so galling, right, to be working on this ARG inside Blizzard and to have been working on it for so long, and then everybody knows what the character looks like. Like you're, the culmination of the ARG has already been seen twice in two different contexts.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when parents plan a surprise for a small child and the child finds out what the surprise is, so the parents have to think of other things that will make the day more exciting.
It really, like,
you've spoiled the surprise.
Honest to God though, they, like, this can't be now. That puts them in an awkward position because now, like, well, they have put themselves in an awkward position because they have BlizzCon, which is supposed to be their opportunity on the main stage of BlizzCon to go out and basically just have a big Oprah moment in front of like their most passionate fans. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been to two BlizzCons and you can never not get caught up in it because every time, it doesn't really matter what they're announcing, everyone goes berserk. Like last year was when they revealed the characters, like I guess the rest of the Overwatch roster. So it's like Genji, D.Va, and one other character.
May
as well. And people were like going bananas. And it was a much more successful example of the same thing, partly because there had been not an ARG, but a sort of a fan led initiative to find out who's the green ninja. Cause Genji's in like the first Overwatch trailer and some of the concept art and stuff. And then there was this fan thing of like, what if he's Hanzo's brother? And like that had gone spiraled off and ended up that governed the sort of fandom Tumblr chat about the game. And so the moment in that BlizzCon trailer where Hanzo says brother and like the entire room went, or, you know, substantial part of it went fucking berserk. And there's basically like that, you know, that company has a rabid fan base and perhaps they will all politely pretend to be surprised anyway, but they sort of need something else now, I think.
I think it's a bigger deal now because it's out. So like just one new character is quite a big deal.
Yeah.
But then, so they also, there's been some art leaked of a Diablo character, right? And it's a necromancer, and that, it looks very much like that's an expansion and not Diablo 4. And so if everyone's expecting Diablo 4 and a whole bunch of other stuff, and they get the character they already knew was coming to Overwatch and a character for Diablo,
so
that'll be a disappointing.
Do you think that the Diablo stuff would have been leaked to actually temper people's expectations?
Maybe. I don't think so. Blizzard is so controlling of them, the way they deliver that information, that I don't know.
They've been doing really badly then.
They have had it. I mean, the So the necromancer thing is a piece of art of two necromancers, actually, but obviously the male and female versions of the same character.
How do you know they're necromancers?
They have the same sort of profile and weapons as the necromancers.
They got
they're also like raising the dead at the time.
They're literally raising the dead. Yeah. Like, they're doing the most necromancer thing.
Yeah, it's very...
Plus the image is green, so...
She's got a skull floating in her hand.
Yeah, he's got a sickle, I think. Yeah. But, and so there's, you know, it seems likely that it's an expansion because that fits the, it's in Diablo 3's art style, which is one thing. So if it was a new game, you'd expect it to not look quite so
annoying. Yeah, and it feels very much like, a presentation of this as a new character because there's a male necromancer and a female necromancer standing right next to each other in this kind of way that just presents this as like, and here's what the female version looks like. Yeah.
And
new character
that's the best. Well, there's two bits of evidence that this isn't for a different game because one, the Diablo 2 necromancer already came to Heroes of the Storm. As a character, one of the only Diablo 2 characters that has. Well, he was either announced, I think he's out. And that very specific, very Diablo-specific thing of having the male and female variants of the same person. So, it seems likely that that's the case. And if that's the case, and this is the piece of key art for it, then it seems likely that it's an expansion and not a sequel. But...
Which is actually quite exciting to me, because Necromancer was my favourite character in Diablo 2.
And, same.
I never played Diablo 2.
It had corpse explosion.
I think I played Diablo 1.
It's just amazing.
Didn't the Witch Doctor in Diablo 3 get the corpse explosion?
Yeah. I think it doesn't work quite the same way, but I can't remember exactly how. But in Diablo 2, it was just this fantastic, like, tipping point of every fight. Like, all your things are, like, poison-based. It is quite a lot like the Witch Doctor. But you would be sort of trying to, you'd have pets and you'd have poison and you'd be trying to just get that first kill. And as soon as you get the first kill, that guy goes down, you blow up his corpse, it damages everyone around them. They're weak enough that some of them die, blow up their corpses. And then soon it's just explosions just fucking everywhere and just blood going everywhere and everything dying. It's great.
It's great.
I'm racking my brain to try and remember what the name of their first big expansion was.
Reaper of Souls.
Reaper of Souls. I was thinking of something to do with ice or corpses, which would have been... in the same ballpark, I guess. But that was the first time I played Diablo 3, and that felt like a fairly substantial chunk of thing.
Mm.
So I don't know. I don't know if I'm... It's probably going to herald a full re-release of the game,
possibly.
I mean... Destiny style?
Reaper of Souls was the re-release of Diablo 3 because it changed so many of the things that were so unpopular about the game.
And brought it to the consoles as well, right?
And it brought it to the consoles, which is where I played it. Yeah. I don't know. It could... I mean, there have been lame BlizzCons before, and it could be that. And if the sum total of their big reveals this year is an Overwatch character and a Diablo expansion, then it probably would have been seen that way anyway, regardless of all of those things being spoiled.
I don't know. Maybe they'll have a new map for Heroes of the Storm.
I think they might finally release the thing that they announced last year, but then of didn't do.
What did they announce last year?
Arena mode. Actually, I think.
But they've changed it.
They have changed it a lot.
No, it's out. They changed it to Brawl, as a kind of an exercise in branding continuity.
It is. I mean, it's, you know, a fine exercise in branding continuity. You got to rate them for that.
Brawl.
I'm a bit sad that I'm not going, actually, because it's always a load of fun, but it does feel like it's likely to be an off year. But that said, Blizzard, one of those companies that you kind of have to wonder what they're going to do now, because they have nothing, obviously, in the works.
Well, I kind of feel like... It sounds kind of mean, but with Heroes of the Storm, I just sort of feel like they're... spinning their wheels and just making almost like crossover fan fiction of like their own stuff. Like, oh, what if this character and this character hung out, or, you know, whatever
else.
That's
what it is, basically.
Well, exactly. But like, and so with Overwatch, they clearly can produce a new IP, but to me, like, it didn't keep my interest, actually. I will say I haven't played it in like months, but also, it doesn't feel substantially different to other Blizzard games. Like, their world is kind of a mulch of similar art styles and similar thoughts and similar stories in a way that I don't find rewarding beyond a certain point.
Yeah.
So, like, I think my main engagement with it is sort of, there's a kind of, detached amusement just following the subreddit to sort of see what people think is currently an ARG. Or like, you know, when they introduced the Halloween mode and then everyone was obsessed with shooting the birds in a particular order because surely that would unlock an Easter egg or something. And you're kind of like, oh, good Lord. Like,
it'd be interesting to see. Yeah. Cause I mean, this is also probably the first post. This is the first post Metzen BlizzCon, which is something in and of itself. Is he gone? He's gone. Yeah.
Yeah, like, didn't
He announced his retirement.
Aeon, I want to say Galifianakis, but that's Zach.
Yeah.
I can't remember his like handle either, but like the he's taken over as like the lead on Warcraft.
Zach Galifianakis. That'd
be amazing. I'd play that.
It begins with an H. I can't remember.
Galifianakis.
There is something.
Let's have a Dutch. There's say
something
it.
Kind of
between two orcs with Zach Galifianakis.
Oh god. Brilliant. There's something kind of technically interesting about Sombra as a character, even if I'm kind of not tremendously interested by the ARG or by what she's doing, in that Blizzard have spoken about balancing their roster in terms of support and tank and assault and defense characters, leading many people to assume that Sombra is going to be a support. And there was definitely a line of thinking coming from a lot of people that Sombra is going to represent in Overwatch's roster what something like the Spy represents in Team Fortress, essentially a kind of an espionage character, which is interesting because that goes against a really interesting line of criticism, positive criticism of Overwatch, which is that it benefits by not having a spy character, by making everything very visible and very clear.
Well, Blizzard actually specifically said they were never going to do invisibility.
They were never going to... Well, so invisibility is one thing, but the spy can do a lot of bullshit that's not invisibility.
It might be that thing where they've made a very sort of semantic distinction between invisibility and stealth. Or,
camouflage.
So the rumour I heard is that Sombra is an illusion-based character.
So this is
she creates decoys for herself.
I don't want her to be a support, though. I want her to be anything other than a support, because the Overwatch roster skews so heavily towards putting female characters in the support role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's the one where there are equal numbers. Everything else, there's fewer female characters.
I suspect she's quite likely to be a defense or an offense character, because from the art that they have clearly leaked, she doesn't look like a tank.
No.
So there's, I think it'll be one of those two, partly because the last character was a support. So
yeah.
I think it's unlikely that they would do two supports in a row.
Mm.
Yeah. We'll see, I guess. Oh, that's the other weird thing.
All
about
people listening to this will already know.
Yeah, like, is it gonna happen? Are we gonna see it tomorrow or something?
Oh, God knows at this point. If I were Blizzard, I think I would have just given the game up on this particular reveal and put out whatever trailer they were planning to put out early, just to be like, oh, you got us.
And then done some gameplay footage or something.
Yeah, and then done something else at BlizzCon. Like, you know, and look under your seats.
There she is.
And I guess we're still speculating about it, so it's worked to some extent.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Wow, now I feel like a chump.
We were the villains. We were Sombra all along.
The real Sombra was the friends we made along the way.
Sombra was coming from inside the building. Just for the Halloween shocky kind of... version.
Other news this week. What was the other news this week?
Owlboy came out.
Owlboy came out after 9 years.
Yeah. It's a side-scrolling platformer where you play a boy who is part owl and is mute and flies around a bit. I played it in 2011. I mean, you have to start with a millennium, you know. It's been a little development.
3 years ago.
So it's
shit.
Like,
I just realized that wasn't true.
It's been in development 9 years, and it's like the comforting story developers tell themselves when their game's taking too long. Well, it's not as long as Owlboy. It's fine. Like, Spy Party's been 7 years or something. It's not as long as Owlboy, though. It's fine. And now Owlboy's out, so 9 years is your limit, everybody. It's out. It literally came out like an hour before we started this podcast or something.
An owl before.
Why did it take so long?
Read a bit about it, but I didn't get a lot of like nitty gritty details to like. Well, they started it again a bunch of times.
Well, surely that's, you know, you'd have to.
It was like
the
that.
Hardware is just totally obsolete.
Well, like that.
So retro anyway that I don't think is a big factor. But.
It's like that film Boyhood. They had to actually track, follow in real time. Owlboy.
Owlboy had to grow up.
Yeah. It tracks the first 9 years in Owlboy's life. And
but the thing I played.
The journey happens as it happens.
I played 5 years ago. That was 4 years in, and they released a public demo of it, and it was really like polished, and it was quite nice. It wasn't like amazing, and so like the longer it takes, the more I've been thinking like, shit, I hope this is good in the end, because if it's just like extending and repolishing that thing I already played. That thing I already played was just like nice. Just wasn't, you know, like 70% sort of thing. Mm. But reviews are out for Owlboy now. Okay, so reviews are out, and at least I can't remember who, but someone gave it 10 out of 10. Eurogamer have given it recommended. I think, Jack, you were saying that RPS liked it.
Yeah.
Arby's have tweeted about it.
Oh, yes, Arby's tweeted about it.
And just one of those things that you had to read it and then see who it's from and then read it again and then look at the, like, account and check it was real.
Because 2016 is so strange.
It just it is. So Arby's just tweeted, like, the waiting's over, like, time to, I don't know.
Owl.
Time to owl, yeah. Time to owl is very low in Owlboy.
Why not come into Arby's for an owl cheesesteak?
And then it's just hashtag owlboy, and it's like a cardboard sort of cutout of an owlboy standing on some Arby's food. And
the thing is, the
they have 500,000 followers. This is like a huge
God, past thing. A certain point, that kind of bullshit is extremely endearing to me. Like, I don't know.
I think it's we
think a lot more of Arby's now. I can't remember what's called Arby's.
I like that there's a tongue twister in that, basically. It's Arby's Owlboys.
Arby's Owlboys.
Yeah, between Arby's Owlboys. And Owlboys and Arby's and Owlsbees. And Carl's Jr. doing the Waypoint launch, the Vice Gaming Waypoint launch. Yeah, that launch was sponsored by Carl's Jr.
Holy shit.
And at one point they had an actual cow in the studio presenting video games with them. So it's been a big week for fast food companies in strange places.
I'll tell you what, it's been a big week for social media managers. Is the people
social media managers have been going, like, Jesus. Oh my God.
God rest God rest the poor lizard brain of the whoever at EA decided that just World War One things was a great idea for a hashtag.
Yeah.
Over GIFs of, for example, a German soldier incinerating a load of people in an underground bunker with the flashing caption, "When you're just too hot for the club."
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's literally a few months ago, in the office, we were trying to do the back page of the magazine, which, as Tom will know, always happens. Basically, the last day of the magazine.
Yep.
We happen today, actually.
When you're all broken enough to come up with something ridiculous.
Yeah, and we do whatever makes us vaguely laugh at the time, and that'll do. And we were trying to, we'd just done a Battlefield feature, a preview, and we were trying to come up with, like, you know, like, just and we figured out that there's nothing funny about World War One, really. Mm. Apart from the fact that, apart from the kind of the awful appropriation of it by games sort of culture, like that is the only funny thing about it.
Yeah.
And then I said out loud, "Wilfred owned," and
oh god,
and that turned into a back page joke, which I will go to hell for. But it wasn't "Some Like It Hot," so that's that's better. You know, that's not quite as bad. The thing is, it only worked in that context because it was almost about how awful people are. Whereas the EA thing was genuinely, they're trying to build some hype for the weekend,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw the tweet, and I was sitting on my own in a pret-a-manger in Norwich, and two things happened. My heart sank, and then I looked up when the flamethrower was first used in World War One. It was first used at 3:15 a.m. on the 19th of July, 1915, and it killed 700 people, and you can imagine the summer morning and the birds in the trees and the Germans stepping through the trees with the flamethrower canisters on their backs. And we've got, it's just World War One things. EA are tweeting it, and, you know, it just makes your heart sink.
It does. I mean, we were trying to, like, because it feels it's trending in a Black Mirror episode direction, thing.
Yeah.
It's the future where war footage stripped from whatever horrible war is currently happening is overlaid with a fucking Snapchat puppy face.
I know. And don't get me wrong, I'm very fond of Snapchat.
The lick of the flamethrower is the dog's tongue.
I'm very fond of Snapchat. I'm very fond of puppy faces. I'm fond of Instagramming my own and other people's faces. But I don't, you know, come on. A lot of people die.
One thing that's worth stressing, if you weren't around on Twitter for this whole debacle, was after a couple of hours, they actually deleted all the tweets.
They did.
Which implies a not all publicity is good publicity sort of attitude, partly because the hashtag got completely co-opted by people tweeting
tragic facts.
No, just tweeting tweeting like
World War One.
I took a screen grab of the saddest Siegfried Sassoon poem I could find it's short notice, and tweeted that with just World War One things. And so that hashtag was just full of, like, actually quite, I imagine if you weren't necessarily familiar with that poetry, or if you hadn't, if you, like, because the first reply on the flamethrower tweet was someone saying, oh yeah, I just got 18 kills with that on the forest map.
Fucking
and the
hell.
One after that was someone saying, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And then after that, it was all quotes from Wilfred Owen. And that was kind of like, I don't know, hopefully that will, you know, if there's any good to come of it.
Yeah.
But it was a totally, like, those decisions don't get made quickly, and someone had to make those GIFs.
It would have been around for a while as well. Like, I saw there was one, like, 2 days before hashtag that was, like, a bunch of, it wasn't, like, as gross, it was just a bunch of people standing on a blimp, and it was like, is your squad, I don't know, on point or something?
Oh, yeah. Like, was it just, like, squad goals something? Like, squad goals.
Oh, God.
Maybe.
It's so weird. It's such
I think they had a couple of them.
The thing is, if it was... If it had simply been just Battlefield things, we probably would have folded it away with all of the things that are allowed to be in games because whatever.
Like, like murder.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's, you know, I mean, we've already talked about on this podcast about how strange that setting is in some ways.
Yeah.
But, like, it was, yeah, a peculiarly tone-deaf moment because the game isn't about World War One. It's about Battlefield. It's about, you know, Battlefield's game. You know, it's that game, and the people who are buying it aren't like, I want to experience World War One. They want to play the new Battlefield game and do the fun Battlefield things. And that's fine. So they picked the wrong side of the equation. Like, the sad history isn't where they're hanging their
appeal. You can almost see how it came about because the game itself does play the World War One angle, like, really strong, like, from the start. As you said, like, pod before last, the opening section is so much about, like, how it literally says, it ended nothing of the war.
Yeah.
And so, like, that element is in there. And then connecting the lighthearted fun you have with your friends online to that. If it had just been just Battlefield things, I think it would have taken someone else to come along and point out how horrible this was, and it still could have been a total disaster. But they pointed it out themselves.
And it's so frustrating because you can just imagine... what studio makes it? Is it just... Are they just called
Dice.
EA?
Dice.
Yeah.
You can just imagine some, like senior writer at Dice just gets up from their desk and walks out of the office and is just like, fucking hell, guys, come on.
It's more like that out of the window gif that people...
Oh, it's just, it must be so galling. It must be so galling to... Because, you know, they know they're in a kind of lose-lose situation where they have to make this absurd, ridiculous multiplayer shooter about a really horrifying time. And they spend literal years of planning and pre-production and production and development and post-production making sure that it's as good as they can make it. And then some fucking social media manager tweets just World War One things.
Oh my God. There is a part of me that's kind of now just riffing on that sort of horrific collision of memes and, like, the horrors of war. So it's kind of like, all that's going through my head right now is walk into the club like those who die like cattle.
Yeah.
which is horrific, and I'm the one that's now going to hell.
Off.
But yeah, God.
I think it was Chris Schilling who tweeted, bent double like beggars under sacks, a seven nation army couldn't hold me back.
Oh, Jesus Christ. God. Oh, but what's also, you know, the games industry, what's the saying? The games industry giveth with one hand and it taketh with, you know, that saying.
With social media.
With social media. But also Titanfall 2 has come out, and that game is just so explicitly, bizarrely, in its multiplayer at least, joyful. About just, like, robots are falling from space, and they're falling on each other, and this one's called Nosedive or something, and it can kill you with a sword. And, you know, we've got that against this ridiculous sort of overblown play at World War One.
Like, really, really closely compared to it by releasing it the week after.
Right. What is that decision?
At least they didn't release it on, like, Remembrance Day or something, because they could have probably tried to co-opt that. So at least that isn't a thing that's happened.
That would have been very bad.
So Battlefield 1's date
gets your exclusive November 11th poppy emblem.
Yeah, it is to remember both World Wars, isn't it?
So Battlefields make sense, and you want to get out before Call of Duty, obviously. Good move. And then Titanfall, I think once you... Like, apparently, I don't know, some producer said that they had it locked in ages ago and they couldn't change it, or it was never going to be changed. But it should have been. If you delayed it by 6 months and did no day of work on it, you would still make more money from it.
So here's a prediction. I reckon Titanfall is going to get basically a marketing re-release next year. Not on purpose, not planned now, but they will probably realize
special edition.
What they have, and there'll be a special edition in like March.
Well, but they've committed to not selling any new Titans or maps, so I'm not sure how they do the special edition.
I mean, this seems like a good transition into what we've been playing.
Maybe a game of the year edition.
Because it's what I've been playing. So the game has, and I'm probably going to write something about this tomorrow, so it'll be out by the time this podcast goes up, but the game has a good, so it has, they've promised no season pass and no microtransactions. They promised a season pass, they haven't promised no microtransactions, but there aren't any microtransactions at the moment. However, there are a billion hooks for them, so I suspect that it will get them. And they'll be harmless, because all of the hooks are for cosmetic stuff and skins and whatever. So all that a special edition needs to do really is just be the game again, but with some new cosmetic stuff. Right. So just pack that in. And that's fine. Cause that kind of already exists with the various like, digital deluxe editions and stuff like that. It is a strange one because, in a way, I think it's almost sad that the conversation about that game has become, holy shit, why did they release it now? Rather than, holy shit, this is probably the best shooter they've released this year and possibly the best shooter released in the last couple of years. And that's a really interesting situation to be in, because this is ultimately like, and I think this is interesting particularly from a PC point of view, that the game as it currently stands, with the exception of it being on Origin, is pretty much, and also independent of being good, is everything people complain about other games not being, in that it's like a full price AAA game that has a substantial and very good single player campaign as well as a multiplayer mode. So it has both sides of the old equation that people used to expect and that they've gotten used to not getting one half of, normally the single player side. It doesn't also ask you to buy a season pass. And if you compare that to Battlefield, which is its stablemate, which is like the full price of that game, if you want to keep playing it this year, is £100. And it has no microtransactions. It has none of those hooks either. And so it is the sort of, I don't know, the comments thread choice for like, things that are, you know, should be getting kind of celebrated. And I've started to see that in the comments threads on our site. From that sort of often tiresome kind of consumer rights angle, people are sort of starting to realize that this is the one, if you're going to root for a AAA shooter about robot men this year and also World War One, this is the one that you should sort of want to be successful. But it's interesting also sort of watching it not happen as people go, but I don't think it's going to be successful, so I'm not going to buy it.
I was going to say, how are its sales? They're not amazing.
They've been really bad.
Great, yeah.
Like, so maybe next year, once that sort of critical word of mouth has got out, like re-releasing it would be a really good idea so that it gets that push to be in front of people's faces. But
yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. Like, I think word of mouth could do a lot for it because people are playing it and realizing that it's amazing. Yeah, like, that has led to good, very strong reviews, I know, because I wrote one of them. And that will hopefully give them a lot to put around it if they do decide to market it properly. But I know from, you know, direct professional experience, that EA didn't really market that game. Like, they haven't really put any kind of push behind it that I've seen. And that's super strange. And that matters because, you know, it's one thing for it to make all these good decisions, but it's another thing for people to know about them. And marketing does have a role, not in necessarily accidentally, you know, advocating war crimes as a fun night out, but in making people aware of the good things that games are doing.
Yeah.
And they've fucked it, is what they've done.
I've always felt, and I'm interested in unpacking this because I don't... Holy shit. Sorry, all the...
Oh, my monitor just...
The monitor just... Off, so there, and there was...
Plunged us into darkness.
The dark I was spooked. Like you were by the Joker. I'm curious to unpack why I've always felt like Titanfall has been an underdog. And it might just be because I haven't seen the marketing push that I would generally associate with something like that.
The first game got a big push, but that was because it was
like a launch title.
It was extensively Xbox exclusive, but also came out on PC.
So it's Windows-ish exclusive.
I know why it is. It's because I don't feel that game got the audience that it should have done. And at the same time, it was a game that I played a great deal with a very close group of friends. So we all kind of got to the point where we were like, yeah, Titanfall's actually really good. When I don't feel that game, I don't know. I don't feel that that game got the... when it comes down to it, Titanfall is a joyous Mirror's Edge as a multiplayer shooter game that doesn't really care whether or not you're any good at shooters. And that's kind of brilliant.
But it cares if you're bad at shooters.
I would say the shooting is one thing. It cares an enormous amount about how good you are at moving.
Yeah, that's the movement.
I think the interesting, and maybe this brings us to talk about Titanfall, because I would like to talk about it because it is great. And
I want to hear about it.
And also partly the its struggles are maybe illuminating in some ways, but ultimately like the thing it should be celebrated for, or you know, hopefully the thing people should be saying about it is how fucking good it is. Well, one thing about it that's sort of interesting is I think it might have the tribes problem in that it's a brilliantly designed game with every single system offering depth and, you know, potential for the expression of player skill and for crazy emergent things to happen in multiplayer. But that makes it fundamentally complicated and means that the barrier to entry is fundamentally slightly higher than any other game of its kind. And that applies, so just talking about multiplayer for a second, that, you know, applies across the board.
Sure.
Like, you know, Call of Duty in the years since Titanfall 1 has basically nicked the wall running and stuff like that, but it's dialed them all back so that they're not essential. So that a player who wall runs isn't necessarily, or a player who's good at wall running doesn't necessarily have an advantage over a player that just wants to do the traditional COD thing of running a lap around the level, shooting the next guy in the back before being shot themselves in the back in turn. Whereas Titanfall has that old school mentality about it that no, like if you watch the kill cam of the person who just killed you, they're probably moving three times faster than you thought you could because they know how to chain jumps and boosts and slides and grapples and wall runs according to the kind of the, you know, internally consistent but complicated movement logic of the game, which allows you to move. It feels spectacular. When you start playing, you feel rubbish and slow and crap. And when, if you persevere with it, eventually you feel amazing because you can, you know, slide down a hill, boost yourself up into the air, throw a grappling hook sideways to whip around a building, fly up into the air and land on the canopy of a giant robot, pull its battery out, run away and give that to your friend. Like, it's that game and it's amazing. But, you know, we know from, I think Pip and I both have experience of talking to people from Hi-Rez Studios who brought back Tribes.
Mm.
And I spent some time talking to the developers of that because I fucking love Tribes. And, you know, their whole thing was you can't make Tribes because it's too complicated. Like, it's only ever going to play to an audience of a certain size. And I think Titanfall has that not quite as much because it has, they're still Infinity, well, Respawn, aka old Infinity Ward, are still the people that make Call of Duty.
Really good designers.
Yeah, the really, really good designers. And what they've done is make an old school sort of niche shooter on top of the most mainstream shooter ever made.
Yeah. So, they did a beta on the PlayStation, I think it might have just been on the PlayStation, that I played, and so, you know, I've spoken briefly about how much the original Titanfall means to me, both as like a game to play with my friends and also just as a piece of game design. But I played the beta on the PlayStation and my heart sank because I couldn't do anything and I was getting killed and the movement felt strange and it was sluggish. And apparently this was a reaction that a lot of people had to that beta, that various weird game feel elements didn't quite match up with what they were anticipating. And so they did a couple of other betas. And there's a moment at the very beginning of the campaign where you're essentially thrown through a very basic gauntlet of enemies and of wall runs and of these things. And when I eventually sort of bit the bullet and downloaded it on PC and played it with a mouse, there was this great moment when I was playing that gauntlet when I looked at the room in front of me and my brain filled in how to do all the wall runs, and I thought, like, oh, I see, I remember how to play this thing. And it was a really nice moment of... A lot of what makes this game interesting to me is back.
I actually wanted to write about that, but I ended up being able to fit it. It's really
the gauntlets?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, because it's a tutorial. It's how to move and shoot and fire the gun. And then also, you can play it before the rest of the game's downloaded. It lets you load it really soon. And if you... as it's downloading the game, you can play the gauntlet, and there's a character who says, like, come see me when you're done.
He's called Lastimosa, which is a great name.
One of the designers.
Oh, really? Yeah. Lastimosa is such a good name.
It's
such a good
name.
It's a very you name, I think. You name a character.
Thanks.
And he basically won't take you to the next section of the tutorial until the game's finished downloading, but you can play that for as long as you like. And then
what does he say?
It just a text box comes up and says,
no, it's better than that. A percentage indicator appears on your head. I swear that's true.
I'm 70% of the way to telling you you can go.
Yeah.
But initially you do the gauntlet. It's like, okay, we've taught you how to wall run, slide, shoot, etc. Do this gauntlet. And that's first thing. But there's a high school table, which is like, you know.
Fictional characters.
Other fictional characters.
Yeah, I was thrown by that. I thought it was supposed to be reading in my friend's list. And it seemed
it's not. And so you can do it for a long time trying to beat those. And based on your final position, that's the difficulty, it defaults you to. Mm.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It tests you for ages.
So I did it once through and it said, oh, you difficulty recommended regular difficulty. And I thought, yes, you're probably right. I'm going to keep doing it again. I want you to ignore my future performances. Keep on regular difficulty.
Well, what I liked about that scene is that there's unique dialogue for every person you beat on the table.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Lastimizer gives a new line based on who you beat, which I think is really cool.
It's really well built to, like, it's just a finesse course. Like, everything about it is built for you to do it way. And so even the first time through when you don't know the controls properly and you're fumbling around, you'll just accidentally do two or three things in a really cool way.
And then I was like, I can probably do this without touching the floor, right?
Yeah.
And then you do. Can I say a tiny thing about the beginning of that mission that some people might consider a spoiler, but skip
the beginning of the tutorial.
I'm not going to talk about beyond the tutorial.
Yeah, sure.
I think literally the tutorial.
So if you haven't played Titanfall, the narrative underpinning of that game is that people on the battlefield can call these gigantic robots from space, which drop from space. You get a countdown and they drop from space, and then you run and you jump into them, and it's beautiful and it's amazing. And it's what they marketed the whole first game on, that whole prepare for Titanfall thing and the Titanfall. And of course, in the tutorial for this, you run the military gauntlet and you do all the jumps and you're taught how to use infantry weapons, and then you're told, okay, look, here's the thing. We're going to teach you how to use a Titan now. Here's my Titan. You're going to have your own, obviously. Point at a place and press V to call in your Titan. And then you call in your Titan. And at that point, the military simulation that you're in glitches and breaks. And you have to go to war as a standard infantryman.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really beautiful moment of the game. Just saying like, no. You don't get to do
and
this
when it
yet.
Gives you, and like event, it takes a long fucking time to give you that moment.
Of the Titanfall?
Of a Titanfall, yeah. Like,
yeah, because I still haven't seen a Titanfall. I've just got BT at this point.
It's a good place to start because, you know, I went into that game really looking forward to it because I love Titanfall 1, but having no idea that I'd be getting the best shooter campaign that I have played.
Titanfall's so good.
It's so fucking good.
I want to go home and play Titanfall
I want to play Titanfall right now. It's even rare that I spend a lot of time on a game for a review and then come away from it like, this is all I want to play. Everything's great about that game, and I really don't want to spoil key things about it, but.
No, please don't.
It's that tutorial is incredibly well conceived. It teaches you what you need to know, and then it gives you a scaling challenge mode that is incredibly hard to beat. Like, you can get to the top six on the table if you keep plugging at it. But the first position requires you to do it in like less than 26 seconds.
Jesus Christ.
And like, how the fuck do you do that? And that requires killing like 15 people and moving like a 100-meter assault course.
Do you so the first time I did it, I thought I killed everyone. I thought I had to kill everyone. But then when I finished, it said I actually didn't kill someone. If you don't kill someone, does it like add to your time?
Add to time.
Yeah, I think last time it just kind of goes like.
Yeah, so like, you know, the penalty for not killing anybody is 30 seconds. So if you do it in 26 seconds.
You kill someone.
You've killed all of them. So, and it's, you know, it's really well designed. And also it's, you know, it's clever that it allows you to do that while you're downloading the game. And there's all this sort of thought invested into what would just be a tutorial. And then. It does some sort of traditional sort of first-person scripted stuff, and this almost teaches you the basics again through the very beginning of the game. And then when it hits its stride, every mission has what I would think of as the Valve structure for how to make a single-player game. Particularly, and people have compared it to Portal, I think because of one specific environment more than anything else. But actually, the better comparison is Half-Life. And I think people are actually nervous about making that comparison because it's the holy grail that you're not allowed to rub.
That's an impossible game.
Yeah, it's an impossible.
Nobody can make that.
Nobody can make that. Someone made it twice. Like, and the reason for that is because, like, the structure of most games is they add toys as you go along, and they're all about the escalation of those things. If you look at Doom earlier this year, you get more and more powers and toys and gadgets and guns as you go on, and you keep all of them. So the game becomes about this escalation of your armory versus the environment, but it's fundamentally the same game throughout. Titanfall. Which apparently, and this makes a lot of sense, was made through basically an internal game jam. They sent all their designers away
to come up.
They basically come up with how to do Titanfall as a single player game, Everyone comes back with a different idea of how to do that, and then they did all of them.
Carry on.
Yeah, and each mission has its thing, whether that's an environmental thing or a gadget you're given, or just the sort of the type of combat you're engaging in, at what scale, and so on. And it threads a narrative through all of these things, but when that's done, you don't see that stuff ever again. And it's and sometimes you're like, I want that thing back, but that's actually, but it's for the best because it means that you get a really similar experience to Half-Life where you can go from We Don't Go to Ravenholm to Highway 61.
Oh. 17.
Highway 17. Highway 61 is a Bob Dylan album.
I played that album.
And the hovercraft thing.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how just, like, I didn't know that about the Game Jam thing.
And actually, Half-Life 2 is built by cabals, right? They had individual cabals making different sections of the game.
Well, but this is so, I'm trying to think of the word. I guess the word is heartening. For me, as someone who spends some of their time as a game designer, it's just so, I mean, this is a studio that has come from a heritage of making Call of Duty campaigns every year or every other year. And they know how those campaigns work and they know how to make them and they know the pipelines necessary for them. And it's so heartening that sort of a large studio structure and that sort of a degree of pressure would say to their staff and say to their designers who know what they're doing, hey, no, just go and make me some cool levels. And then if they're good enough, we'll put them in the game.
There are lots of individual systems in Titanfall that would be the single big bullet point for that.
God, that's brilliant. That's like, so good.
It makes a lot of sense now that you say that because I've played I feel like I'm most of the way through the campaign and there's a big section that I liked because it was visually interesting, and lots of things were moving around. And now that you say that a bunch of people went off and make their own prototype of what they thought the whole thing should be, or like, you know, what a Titanfall campaign should be, I suddenly realized what the concept of that whole thing was. And I don't want to spoil anything, but it was basically about things moving around. Like, the reason everything was moving around was to make the use of the movement system. Like, the movement system's all about walking on horizontal walls.
You can't just say things like this when I'm in a room without my laptop. I just want to go home and play it.
Yeah, the other great thing, the important thing about all of that is the reason. So, if it was a normal shooter built with that, that mentality, then you get with Half-Life, really. Because Half-Life's pure shooting mechanics are good and they sound good and the weapons are cool. But they're not, I suppose it's always had ideas like the crouch jump and stuff like that. But it feels like sort of teasing at the beginnings of what are interesting ways to move around in an FPS or anything like that.
Do you remember the crouch jump in Half-Life 1 where it's like you have to sprint and then also crouch and then jump from that?
Titanfall's a lot like that. Like, in fact, Titanfall basically has that because the speed boost in multiplayer is functionally slide jump, which is the same.
Jump? Is that something I need to...
I've noticed. I have a quick technical question. I do a lot of melee kills, and I've noticed if I run and slide into a melee kill, I'm expecting to do like a sort of fear-style sweep. If you ducked and attacked in that, you'd do a fear-style sweep. But I seem to always get like a cutscene of a sort of super fancy takedown.
Hold the button.
Ah, okay.
It's the same for Titans. If you get the execution move if you hold the button when a Titan is vulnerable.
So you get a cool cutscene if you hold the button?
Yeah.
It varies
from Titan to Titan. Yeah.
I want to talk briefly about Titans.
Yeah.
In Titanfall,
you came to the right place, Jack.
I want to talk about Titans. In Titanfall 1, there were three Titans. They were called the Ogre and the Atlas and the Striker or the Strider. The Strider? Fast.
Can't remember. I think it was
Jack
Strider.
Jack of all trades and very slow and explosive. The Ogre has a power, which is my favorite power in any multiplayer game, which is that you can blow your own Titan up with the force of a nuclear explosion. So you can just walk into a scenario and go, all right, that's it for this Titan. I'm going to eject, the Titan's going to explode. It's interesting that Titanfall 2's campaign seems to be about fronting this idea that, like, the bond between a pilot and a Titan is sacred. But they've scrapped all the Titans that we knew and loved from Titanfall 1.
And replaced them with six new ones.
With six new ones. So I had to ask on... The monitor turned off again. I had to ask
too
on...
Too spooky to function.
I had to ask on Twitter, I love playing as the Ogre. What is the Ogre?
Legion.
People say Legion. They say Scorch or Tone.
Legion, Scorch or Tone. Because there's this like... So, I on this topic had a comment which was like, I really hate what they've done with Titans, it feels more restrictive. And actually, I mean, it's worth stressing that most of this bears to multiplayer. In single player, you can equip BT with any of the six loadouts.
Fucking brilliant.
And you can change that on the fly. And people forget that.
Amazing.
You can change it like mid-combat.
Yeah, you can change, like, you can constantly switch. So you can, like, I want to fly now, and now I want a sword, and all the rest
people
of it.
People say Scorch is interesting because he has an AoE attack that can hurt yourself.
Yeah,
sure can.
That's my favorite bullshit.
I've killed myself many times.
My favorite bullshit is that.
You set yourself on fire quite a lot. So what they've done, like, multiplayer is really interesting because I think the reason some Titanfall 1 players have gone, what? Is because it is a game that has all of the same vocabulary as the first game, but they've completely remade it. Like, it doesn't have any of the same... Well, none of the same modes work the same way. Movement is rethought. Like, it has, you know, NPC minions and jumping and titans and titan cooldowns and stuff like that, but everything works differently. And for the better, I think. It's fixed so many problems. Things that were slightly out of balance or made for a bad experience but were cool ideas in the original game have been made to work, like rodeoing when you jump on a titan and ride around and to kill it.
Yeah.
In the first game, that was a problem because what happened was you jumped on somebody and you grabbed the back of their titan and you fired your gun into the back of their titan until it died, which meant that if you were in the titan, you needed to get rid of the dude that was riding around on you.
Electric smoke.
Which meant electric smoke, which was basically an optional kind of equip in Titanfall 1, wasn't optional at all.
Electric smoke is such a great combination of words. That's all I wanted to say.
And so it made this thing that should be optional not optional because you had to deal with the fact that you could be killed. And having a little man riding around on top of your robot was basically a death sentence for the robot. And there was no... unless someone shoots him off you.
Yeah.
Or you get out, shoot him, and get back off. And so they've changed that. So now you jump on a Titan and an animation plays where you pull their battery out. And if they don't have a battery, you throw a grenade down the hole. And that's it. And then you jump off again immediately. So electric smoke is useful because it puts them off. And if you're on low health and you try and do that to a Titan that's in electric smoke, you won't survive long enough to finish the animation.
Yeah.
But then once you've lost your battery, your shield goes down. And you're now much more vulnerable. But the battery is a physical object that's carried by the Titan that's taken it. So you can get out of your Titan, kill the man, take your battery back, and put it back in your Titan.
Oh, and I guess simultaneously, your own teammates can replenish
that.
You.
Yeah.
I haven't played the multiplayer yet. Do you get a UI notification when a friendly Titan is lacking a battery?
You can see it because you can see all the health bars. So
is a battery, it's just, you have one of them, right?
It's like on your
BT
hit.
Has three.
Because in the single player campaign, I had to get a bunch to power them up. And then also now in combat, I also pick them up to heal myself.
Yeah, so that's a single player mechanic.
But that's a different thing.
Okay. Yeah, that's a single player mechanic. That sort of simulates the same thing. But like I've done this while playing with friends where, because, you know, when it's the same as in the first game, Titans can enter like a doomed state where the reactor's exposed.
Oh, yeah.
And the Titan
The crossbar.
That's when you can eject, but it's also when you can nuke yourself if that's what you want to do.
Can you do that with any Titan?
It's just second health bar,
right?
Basically. Like, you have your
first... No, sorry, I mean the nuke thing.
It's a perk.
It's a perk on every Titan now. So yeah, so you can equip it at the cost of something else. You can bring a Titan back from Doom by giving it a battery, which means that you can have that thing of like, don't eject! You can rip a battery out of an enemy Titan and take it to a friendly Titan and plug it into them.
Nice.
And so what they've done is taken a cool idea, the rodeo thing, which half worked in the first game but didn't really, and rebuild it so that it starts to create more moments. And what I was going to say, just to finally get around to answering the question you asked about Titans, is they have come up with a new set. They're very nice and I like them. They've come up with a new set and they've... rethought them. They're equivalents to the old ones, but there's no direct equivalence. Because what they've done, and it's similar to what they've done with all of the combat, is they've made Titans fighting Titans a lot more lethal and a lot less forgiving. And if you don't manage your cooldowns well, then you're probably fucked. But they've also made each Titan way more situational than they used to be. So previously they were fast one, medium, and big fat one.
The big pal.
And that's still the case, but there's like fast and melee, which is the Ronin, which has the sword, and there's fast and sniper, which is North Star, which is the one that can fly.
I love that one.
Yeah.
Can fly?
Several of them can fly, actually. Well, Brute can fly as well.
Brute can fly briefly.
There's a Titan called Brute?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, I think Brute is single player only.
Right, okay.
Basically, they have different cores, which is like the old ultimate abilities build up. The North Star core is flight core, which allows you to kind of fly around and fire rockets down like Farah and Overwatch.
It feels so good.
It's so good. And then there's yeah, like Legion's core gives it like the world, the biggest smart gun, you know, the one that auto targets. So it just sort of hits everything.
Yeah.
But basically each of them has like an optimal range and an optimal kind of way of engaging. And a few of them can switch up. Like Legion's whole thing is it can't dash, but it can recalibrate its gun from short range to long range.
Fucking brilliant. I love that.
But that has a big animation associated with it. So if you get it wrong. And so the whole game is actually like about picking your fights so that they suit your Titan versus the enemy Titan. And it's actually, in amidst all of the spectacle, it's actually quite a lot thinkier than the first game was. And there are a bit less, like, just killstreak rewards. You kind of have to know how and where to use them to kind of get the most out of your specific Titan. And, yeah, and I basically only use Legion because I love them. And they all have different voices and different personalities, which is the best
thing.
Can you
switch out the voices? Because I remember they had a great patch for Titanfall 1 where you could basically... So a thing I really liked about Titanfall 1, and I have a podcast called Friends at the Table. It's an actual play podcast with Austin Walker. And just after Titanfall 1 came out, we began our big cyberpunk campaign, which we played for like 90 hours, which was ridiculous. But Titanfall 1 was such a key sort of inspiration for making this thing, this weird sort of Neil Blomkamp style futuristic thing. Where you could essentially build your own Titan, you know? I had an ogre with a certain voice pattern and a certain loadout called Rosemary that you could, you know, drop from the sky, and Austin Walker had a certain striker called Juniper that he could call in or whatever. And I wonder whether or not having these new characterful Titans with these new voices kind of reduces that aspect a little.
I don't think so, because...
I can bring Rosemary back?
It's a very fast game. You don't necessarily customize it, but I feel very attached to, like... to the Titan that I use, partly because every time he has, there's a few different things I say.
Does he have a name?
Not yet. I haven't really thought about that. There's the Titan called Ion, and I keep calling him internally Ian.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've just realized that on Jack's deathbed, he's gonna, with his dying words, just say, Rosemary. What was Rosemary?
It was
what
the was Titan.
Oh, it was that Titan with this voice pack and this special ability. Okay, sorted.
There's actually a villain in Titanfall's campaign called Kane, so that works completely.
Titan Kane.
Like, they all have different voices and stuff, and whenever I get into Legion, I genuinely do believe that Legion is the gentleman's Titan.
oh my god.
Because he's sort of big and slow and protective. But when you get in, and some of them are quite like authoritarian, and some of them are sort of quirky or whatever, and when, when you get into Legion, he says, "Hello, pilot. We are better together." And I'm like, "Yes, we are."
It's the Jack Johnson song.
Yeah. Legion's got the sort of Optimus Prime thing, but also when they have really characterful animations, so when they have just landed, they are now in like a dome shield, unless you choose to get rid of that. You can basically have them land with a dome shield that damages anything that enters it, including Titans, quite severely.
That was in Titanfall 1.
It was in Titanfall 1, yeah. Actually, so it is the same sequence. Or you can choose Warp 4, which is where they actually like hyperspace jump
and they
land a lot quicker. But when they are like either waiting for you and they haven't kicked into their AI control mode yet, or you haven't gotten in them, they each do like a different pose that's kind of like characterful. And well, more like a kind of ready pose. And Legion's ready pose is like somewhere between like a sumo wrestler and like a haka dance. So it's like
Ogre
down.
Did that originally, right? Yeah,
might be
Ogre
the Ogre
did
pose,
that.
But it's so kind of like,
what's a haka dance?
It's like the
Maori
the traditional dance,
like the All Blacks do.
And so, I don't know, it gives you a very profound feeling if you've got your robo bro.
Have you played it, Pip?
No, I hate Titanfall.
What?
Not hate it, I hate how bad I am at it, so I don't enjoy
playing.
Do you love
but what
about
robots?
Single player?
I really like robots, but Chris can kind of attest to this because it's embarrassing how much I really hate being bad at that game. And like, I had to like leave the room and have a cry because I was so bad at it.
I'm sort of not, I might try the multiplayer, but I'm expecting not to like it. But I was excited about this because of the single player. Like, everyone raved about Titanfall 1, but didn't have single player, so I didn't play it. And Titanfall 2 does.
Yeah, maybe that would help.
So here's what I would recommend with the Titanfall. If you're interested, if you're not the sort of person who plays multiplayer a lot, but is interested in playing multiplayer Titanfall, I guess, I'd recommend picking up Titanfall 1, which is about £4. I would recommend, if you can, assembling a group of friends. But otherwise, Titanfall 1 added a really fantastic cooperative mode that is just brilliant and absurd, in which they essentially throw... It's Horde mode, basically, where they just throw Titans against you with different loadouts that you don't otherwise see in the main game, and you can just work together as a team and learn the mechanics and generally get completely stomped by a load of Titans that you don't expect at all. There are these things called specters in Titanfall, which are essentially like robot soldiers, and you can play as them in Titanfall 2, which is brilliant.
Yeah,
the specters have these amazing animations where they like leap over buildings and things. And in the Titanfall 1 co-op mode, you get these characters called Suicide Specters, which is kind of a gross name. So my friends and I started calling them Popcorn Specters. And they're just whole
they're
armies.
In Titanfall 2 as well.
The Popcorn Specters come back?
Yeah. Well, yes, in spirit.
Oh my god, they're explosion. Really frightening. See, yeah. You get about 40 robot enemies that can leap over buildings and want nothing more than to run towards you or your Titan and explode fiery. Oh,
yeah. Are these the ticks in Titanfall 2? I know.
Nope. Oh, I'm excited. I'm so excited that popcorn enemies come back. Yeah, that's really cool.
Once you pop, they'll never stop.
They will never stop. But no, Titanfall's great. Titanfall's great. It's really good.
When I got access to the electric smoke grenade as a pilot, I read both of those words and I absorbed the full meaning of one of those words. And I threw it into a bunch of enemies and was like, yes, now I can run in and melee them all.
This is electrical smoke.
Then I discovered that there's an extra element for smoke. It's not simple normal smoke.
Can we just go
it's
real
a special
talk.
Kind of smoke.
Can we go real talk for a second here? How does electric smoke work?
I was actually thinking about this today. I was like, I imagine it's a bit like being in a sauna. But electric.
So, well, and this is kind of a
our sauna's electric.
Maybe this is kind it's of like a... static electricity. It just does like a little cloud.
Like,
yeah, like all of our hair will suddenly really. Go a bit annoying. Crazy.
This is kind of a segue. My younger sister and I are both big Hitman fans. And when I texted her saying they've brought out a new Hitman level and it's in a luxury spa and hospital in Japan, she texted me back immediately saying, can we kill someone with a sauna? And I didn't know the answer to this, because I know you can kill people with saunas in previous Hitman games.
Yeah, Hitman 1, you can do it.
And in real
wait,
life.
Really?
You can totally...
Yeah. I mean, theoretically.
And so it was with great glee that I haven't played the new level yet, because I'm fairly behind in Hitman, but I do what I always do when a new Hitman level comes out, which is load it up and allow myself to just walk around the opening room and then quit. And also look at the list of challenges that the game makes available to you, and one of them is kill so and so with the sauna. So I was like, yes, okay, we can do this.
That's funny, because I do almost the opposite. Like I'll just go into it and I'll just try and do the mission, and I won't look at the challenges at all to find out what's available, like for my first go at least, and then run it that way. And it doesn't work that well.
My problem with Hitman is that I'm very anxious as a human. Mm-hmm. And so I will tend to avoid playing the Hitman main missions for as long as possible, because I'm worried that I'll screw it up in some way that, you know, doesn't really matter, whatever. So I'll tend to play most of the escalations or most of the contracts or things in a level before I decide to actually take on the main mission or the main opportunity, when I'm like, all right, I've got this map now.
How are you with the elusive targets?
I'm very bad at the elusive targets, like Tom.
Anxiety inducing.
The elusive targets, I didn't realize the elusive targets, I feel they communicated the stakes with the elusive targets very badly. Should we say what elusive targets are?
Yeah, we've talked about them before.
Okay, people know what elusive targets are. Okay, cool. I don't know. I misunderstood that you can restart an elusive target as many times as you want, provided you don't begin the hit.
Yeah.
So until they die or you die, you're good.
I've never done that, though.
No, I feel like that's right. So the other thing is that, like, I live in a bad house where the internet cuts out constantly. So the first time I played the elusive target, when I didn't know this, I was afraid that the internet was going to just die halfway through the mission and I would just be stuck there. But no, I'm very bad at elusive targets. I like to play them. I have a bad habit with stealth, which is that I tend to try and play missions perfectly. Mm-hmm. If someone spots me, I'll tend to try and restart it. Partly because, and I think Hitman lends itself to this really well, it gets me to a point where I can perform this weird complex dance of a level where I'm doing such bullshit things that I've essentially Edge of Tomorrow'd it, you know, where I'm like, I know exactly how long it's going to take for this character to pass across this hallway or whatever, which is so frustrating at first, but it does mean that when my final run, which takes about 6 minutes, is the culmination of 8 hours of play. And it's just this fantastic thing. So Elusive Targets are sort of feel built to challenge me in that regard.
Yeah. They, I actually, the Elusive Targets, I like the novelty of that one-shot type thing.
Yeah.
And I would play them in a very different way, and I would just make absolutely sure I got the target in some way and didn't care too much about doing it cleanly. I'd look for a clean way, and then usually I'd find, oh, the clean way is either it's impossible or it's so tedious that I'm not willing to do it.
Yeah.
But then in every other situation, if I can't load a save game, I don't want to play it. Like the contracts that you play, like that other people have created, you're not allowed to save during them or load during them, so I just don't want to play. It's just like, I'm just in Hitman, I die so much to bullshit. It's so often like, oh, why the fuck did that happen?
Well, but you and develop, so, I don't know. So I'm a small baby child in the games industry. and the games I grew up on, the games that were the first games I ever played, were the Thief series. And you know, so I
Did you play Thief 1 when it came
out?
Yeah,
oh yeah.
Okay, you're not that young.
well, but I mean, as opposed to, you know, like growing up with, like, The Good Mario Man. So I grew up...
Whatever you grew up playing. Tom, you know, Granddad. Like...
yeah, Tom, what did you grow up playing?
Ultima Underworld 1.
I don't know what that game is.
It's a precursor to Thief.
Right, so I grew up... I don't know, I grew up with definitely gaining a tolerance to trying to play these levels flawlessly, which doesn't mean that I save scum it. It just means that when I fuck it up, I tend to restart immediately, which sounds so brutal, but something like
it is.
It's essentially permadeath stuff, as opposed to save scum stuff. But something like New Hitman, what do we call the New Hitman? Hitman 2016.
Yeah.
Is so good at encouraging this style of play, I think.
Encouraging which one? Save scumming or restarting?
Permadeath. Stealth permadeath. Huh. Because the levels are so sprawling and so full of various bizarre...
That makes me save scum. Because it took me a really long time to get to this situation at all.
It's a reflex.
Fuck it up.
Just, well, right. But I don't know. I think about this a lot when I play Escalations.
I like save scumming, by the way. Like, I'm happy.
Oh yeah, no, I will also save scum. I save scum stuff like Dishonored and things like that. But something like Escalations.
Chris is shaking his head sadly.
Really? Hey, I've paid
Leave
my dues. I've paid my dues with Hitman.
Everyone can pick one stealth game that they get really purist about.
Right. I guess mine's Hitman. I don't know. I think this is born of playing Absolution when it came out, which was a game that I did not like, but I thought it was fine. Like, it was, and I'm putting such heavy inverted commas.
Well, high 60s.
It was fine.
It was a review score, I would say.
But I was playing this.
Yes.
I was playing this game in permadeath stealth mode, with my sister, who I, you know, grew up playing these stealth games with. And, I got myself into what I can only describe as an intractable situation in a sort of lobby of an orphanage. Where, as far as both of us could tell, we were essentially completely fucked by the game. And we spent about 3 days desperately trying to work out how to, like, observe these weird stealth systems to the point where we could complete this mission. And once you get to that point, you start getting into really interesting things where you're exploiting not just what you logically think is correct about stealth, but you're exploiting things like, even though this character appears to be turning to face me, he's not. or like, he can't see me. Or like, I can throw this object over here and it won't affect AI, but that means that I can go and pick it up later and do this thing. And so spending a few days, a few actual real-world human days breaking this level has gotten me to a point with Hitman where I have a great fondness for trying to, like, do legitimately absurd stuff with that game, and trying to... But that doesn't also mean that I'm good at it. I feel that permadeath stealth encourages players being bad and encourages players fucking up really spectacularly and then learning how to get past that.
And that's exactly why I don't like it, because for me, if I know I can't load a save game, I just don't try the interesting stuff, because I lose so much if it goes wrong.
It's what
I just don't do the really fun things.
Yeah, it's what killed Elusive Targets for me, and in a way that's sort of drably realistic. It's like, I need to kill this person. If they ever go outside, particularly if they ever go outside in the intro video that plays before you get to assassinate them, I'll know roughly where they're going to be outside, and I will shoot them with a gun from far away, because that turns out that's a really good way of killing
people. It's a top assassination technique, actually. Yeah. It's time honored.
With gun.
So Alice and I played this contract in Sapienza, which is the second level of Hitman, and is my favorite level that maybe humans have made in the last 5 years.
You're going to go further.
Get halfway through Titanfall.
It's okay. I'm excited.
Seriously.
Well, yeah, I'm excited. I mean, like, Jordan Thomas and JP LeBreton stuff in Bioshock was great, and then Sapienza came along. Sapienza is this Italian town, and it's just a town with everything that you'd expect to be in a town.
Ice cream, a church.
Ice cream, a church.
The two things you'd expect.
The two things you expect in a town. A mansion. So we were doing a contract in this town where we were hired to assassinate a man called Mads. The contracts give you names, which is so good. We were assigned to target Mads and another person. And we found that while we could kill the first person fairly easily, Mads would walk down through the town until he reached a post box. And then he would stare at that post box until God destroyed the earth. and so we realized that we could either attempt to kill Mads first, which was not an option because we needed to kill the other guy first, or try and find some bizarro way of getting Mads away from the post box.
That he loves so much.
That he loves so much that he's willing to stand there until the final trumpet sounds.
Can we kill him from inside the postbox?
We just hide
mail
the
yourself
postbox.
To the postbox.
He opens the postbox to post a letter, and he posts the letter directly into 47's mouth.
Yeah. Well, disguise yourself as a postbox.
And 47 could stab him through the front of the postbox. The slot, you know, just like stick a knife out, and no one would suspect except the postman, who then has to let you
out.
The postman comes along and is just like, Jesus Christ.
What I'm saying is choke out the postbox, take its clothes, its sure, postbox
sure,
skin.
Right.
Leave a naked postbox just lying there on the street. Exactly.
And then stand there, and when he comes along, when Mads comes along, lead him away gradually with your alluring postbox.
Sorry, I should just tell listeners at this point that Mads is wearing a Hawaiian shirt. I just need you to picture.
So that Mads' dream has really come true, the enchanted postbox has come to life to lead him
Mads
to...
Mads loves that shit.
Take him to the end of the pier at Sapienza and then just gently
Mads
push him
will be together always and push him into the sea.
But then won't you have like a bunch of like citizens walking past and going, hey, postbox, great postbox.
Oh, nice postbox. I see you're sending some mail there.
I'd be posting something in you, but I've got no letters.
No, so,
but I do see that you're a postbox. I acknowledge that.
But the kind of the rolling battle that emerged between Mads and us revealed something important to us, which is that essentially Hitman 2016 is the sequel to The Last Express we've always wanted, which is that whenever you start that level, everything is happening at once, minus some kind of main story stuff in the main missions, which requires you to trigger it. But for the most part, the main actors of that game are all kind of happening simultaneously. And so Alice and I figured that if we can't kill Mads when he's at the post box, we might be able to kind of stall him so his position in time becomes unstuck from all of the other actors in the level. So that meant that we would begin the level, and we'd walk up to Mads, and he'd be leaning against the wall smoking before his, you know, walk to the postbox.
The final walk.
And before his final walk to the postbox. And then he would get up and begin walking, and we would very gently bump into him. And he'd turn around and look at us and say, hey man, what's going on? Meanwhile, the level is continuing. All the people are beginning to move into their positions. Mads continues to walk through the town. We bump into him again. He stops. The two guards that would notice us when he's at the post box move very slightly and walk away. So by the time Mads is at the post box, which he's going to stare into until the angels come, the people who were supposed to be there aren't. And we've essentially pushed him very slightly out of time, which means it's a great moment to strangle him with some wire and hide him in a dumpster. And we called this technique Mads stalling. And we have begun to apply Mads stalling to various levels. And it works.
Yeah, you
really,
can do this
really
to like bodyguards. There's a bodyguard.
Can you Mads stall
to
some bodyguards?
Yeah, so like most of the targets have a bodyguard who follows them everywhere. You can just keep bumping into the bodyguard.
And they get increasingly detached from
They're only paid to walk at about 3.5 miles an hour and
sure,
no faster.
Right.
So if they end up behind, like, so be it. Drown them in a toilet, I don't care. I'm I'm not going more than 3.5 miles an hour.
This is fascinating with like Novikov, the enemy in the very first level, the one of the targets in the first level has a bodyguard who, and I don't know whether or not, I might have seen you talking about this, where if you kill Novikov's bodyguard, another bodyguard just peels out of the crowd and replaces him. Which is the most beautiful fuck you to the player. Who's been like planning so hard, like I'm gonna poison the sushi and then I'm gonna get rid of the bodyguard and then I'm gonna... But like it makes sense in the level.
You get a window to do it in. Because that's how I did it.
But if one of the bodyguards just sees their dude walking around with no bodyguard, they're gonna go like, oh sure, okay, I guess I'll shadow that guy.
I love that they will, I don't know, like they're going further and further towards like, realistic AI. I know they're not there yet, but like they want the guards to respond to things guards would respond to. And I even remember someone saying of an early Hitman, oh, it's dumb that like when you leave weapons lying around, they don't notice that there's like a fucking assault rifle lying in the street. And someone at IO was like, oh yeah, we're gonna fucking do that. We're gonna make every single time an AI sees a weapon, they will say a special line about it and they'll go and pick the weapon up.
Oh, wow, you really are an AK-47.
Dressed up as an AK-47, I see.
Dang, a gun.
But it means if you actually like kill a bunch of people and then other people who don't know that you're evil yet, like walk into the area, just like a limitless supply of guards will spend a limitless amount of time picking up the guns of all the dead people.
Well, I saw a so there is a sort of a stealth playing Hitman called Silent Assassin where you don't get spotted at any point and nobody basically knows you're there. And I saw someone attempt to complete a Paris level with an unsilenced shotgun as Silent Assassin. Suit only.
That's, yeah, I love doing that.
This is like a level of difficulty that it takes demons to conceive of. And they began to use a technique that I now have to try and employ, which is essentially smuggling weapons past guards by causing them to believe they've been left on the floor. So they left a shotgun on a ledge and then stepped back, shot the shotgun with a silenced pistol, so it fell down the ledge and landed on the floor, where a guard went like, oh, a shotgun.
From the sky.
And carried it to the place where it needed to be. Excellent. At which point, 47 goes and chokes out that guy and takes the shotgun. Which is just beautiful emergent play. It's just fantastic.
I actually killed Novikov the first time I played that mission by, sort of half accidentally, half on purpose, dropping a gun on the floor, basically because I didn't understand how the inventory worked. At which point, a passerby took the gun, and then I think they're programmed to, if they find a gun, go like, oh boy, a gun! And then take it to somebody, like a more senior guard than them. So, they, you know, if it's a civilian, they'll take it to a guard. And the guard they chose was Novikov's bodyguard, who turns around and goes, well, guess this is a gun. I better go put it in the box. I put guns in. So he walks up and leaves Novikov by himself. So I then immediately drowned Novikov in the toilet. And you have to imagine that guard coming back and going, oh, shit.
In retrospect, the gun was not the threat. It was more the assassin than the gun.
With each new level, they add some new weapons and things. Like then the most recent level, the finale, has added a knife that you can hide and can't be detected on frisks, which is really interesting since the final level, you can't
stick
bring
it up your bum.
You can only bring in one.
I was going to say, do you swallow it?
I don't know. I think it's like a flick knife. You can only bring in one weapon in the final level, which is like such a great final escalation in the game, where you've been able to bring in weapons all through the game, and in the very final level, you can only bring in one. But in the Colorado mission, which was the penultimate one, they added for the first time an injectable emetic. And in Hitman, the emetic is just this like crucial tool in your arsenal, which allows you to poison someone non-fatally so they run to a bathroom and throw up, which separates them, and then you can, you know,
that's how you drown them in the
glug 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 glug. And so by adding an injectable emetic, previously you'd had to add it to drinks and things, now we can inject people with them. It kind of reveals that Hitman has a meta that has been developing as they've been introducing new maps and new levels and new elements.
How is this an advantage? Because surely to inject them, you need to get them alone in the first place, right?
No, because it's like the lethal injection. You can just go up and go, boop.
Wait, you can inject someone without
anyone noticing?
Don't shout
boop. That gives the game away.
Don't shout boop. You can.
That's how the first three
hitmen. I didn't realize
the first 46 hitmans were caught.
I believe you can inject someone with what the game calls, brilliantly, modern lethal syringe. as opposed to old lethal syringe. You can go boop. And I believe, and I haven't tried this, everybody believes it's a heart attack.
So they don't see you inject them?
No, because you just go boop.
You can be seen doing it.
I hear the word boop, I'm just not totally picturing what it represents.
You just go up and go boop.
It's like when you go to the doctors and they're like, and they go, you feel a small boop. Like,
right. Have you seen, by the way, has anybody here tried to throw a propane tank at somebody yet?
Yes.
The animation on that.
Tried to throw a what, sorry?
A propane tank. So I thought that what 47 was going to do was kind of, I'm miming on radio now, was kind of do an underarm toss.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what he does. He takes the propane tank, he puts it behind his head with both arms, and he flings it like that.
So you're used to just being able to get away with whatever shit you do to people in public and apparently not being registering as a hostile act.
Right, but he's just zoing. It's great.
Because there are, like, as someone who's read books about the history of assassination for some reason, there are devices where, like, I remember seeing an umbrella where the tip of it is a syringe.
Oh, yes.
And it's for, like, as a gentleman in London walking past your assassination target and just, like, that accidentally bumping
Russian
into them
thing.
And
was,
jabbing them into
it?
A...
actually happened.
Yeah.
Who was that?
I really can't remember.
It was an ambassador.
It was, like, quite... yeah, it was a famous method of assassination.
Yeah.
It's the Mary Poppins Assassin's Creed crossover.
Yeah.
So I've never seen this, but I've always thought, if you wanted to shoot, like, a poison dart into someone in a public place, like, or any kind of silenced...
Oh, no.
Silence
this sounds
attack.
Like a crime.
It is a crime, and it's a plan for a crime. But it's a very good one, in my defense.
It's okay, this isn't being recorded.
Why can't you build it... why don't you build it into a telescopic lens for a camera, which is a thing you're allowed to have in public, and point at important people?
Oh, shit.
Crucial times. Mm. I've never seen that as a gadget, but it must exist.
Do you know what they should do?
What?
Selfie stick. Seriously.
Wait, how do you...
A selfie stick.
Oh, I know.
A selfie stick is the rifle.
Right, no,
so you're pointing
right.
it at yourself because you're looking at taking a photo yourself. Great. But the camera on the end of the selfie stick is a gun sight.
Alternatively, you have a selfie stick like this and then you just go and beat someone to death with a selfie stick.
That's if it fails.
Right, exactly.
The gun doesn't fire.
Exactly. God, I don't know. I think that, like, they've done so much... I really want to try and get an interview with some of the Hitman design team, because it feels like they've done so much stuff in this game to, in contrast to the previous game, characterize 47 without playing their hand at all. It feels like in this game they tried to characterize 47 emergently and by having him
as a fucking madman.
Right. No, absolutely.
Stop throwing bricks at people,
so
47.
My read of 47 in the previous game was just this ridiculous mid-2000s Dour Games Boy. And in this, he's basically Martin Blank from Gross Point Blank, where he just goes on holiday to places and is just like, oh, fuck me, I've got to, Christ, I've got to do a hit while I'm here. Okay, what have I got? I've got a brick, I've got a propane tank, I've got a small bust of Mozart. What the fuck am I supposed to do with any of this shit?
I killed the president of Paraguay with a fork.
Well, I killed the president of Paraguay with a fork. Right. But at the same time, there's that great bit in Gross Point Blank, and I realize this is a very niche reference. Where after a whole movie of doing nothing, Martin Blank performs a perfect flying kick on an assassin and knocks a gun out of his hand. And just like that, 47 is sometimes in these moments where he's like, ah, I can punch that mime.
That's not too ambitious, is it?
Mime is no problem for me. He's gone. And so in the most recent episode, each episode has started with 47 in a particular situation in Sapienza. He's just on holiday in Colorado. He's disguised in a trench coat at the outside of the facility. In the most recent one in this luxury hospital, he's a patient in a kimono, just in a hospital room. And I'm so curious about what that implies narratively about what 47 can do. Of just like, 47 has gotten into a position where he's like, ah, my kidney's all fucked. I need to go to this. Yeah, I've got really bad kidneys. Can I please go to this hospital? My name's Jeremy Spicer.
Is that what he gives his name as?
It's something Spicer. It's just like
usually he gives his name as Tobias Reaper, which is not a great cover name for an assassin.
It's me, Toby Death. It's me,
James Death.
It's me, Toby Death. What's that in my pocket? A brick? No. Never killed anybody.
I think you should just go around the world as Michael Stipe.
John.
You keep running into people you can replace because they happen to be bald.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
there's so many bald celebrities. And...
There's a mechanic in Hitman where you can see through people's disguises. Or rather, you can tell who can see through your disguise by whether or not they have a sort of white dot above their head. We call those people Noahs. Like, you know, that's a John Noah. He knows who John is. It's a Noah. But in a really nice bit of just like carefully implied narrative, there are generally a couple of people in each level who know who you are without a disguise. And I'm not talking about guards or things, just someone lounging on a bench or, you know, sitting in a place. There is the implication.
Oh, the private detective in Sapienza.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There's the implication, and the fortune teller in Marrakesh. There's the implication that there are a group of people in these levels who just for some reason are like, oh my god, I know who you are. You're really bad news.
It would make sense that a fortune teller would know this.
It's so good. Have you seen the dialogue?
I
to be honest, any cashier
any
with a barcode scanner could figure
about
that
today
out.
It's okay.
There's the dialogue is actually really fantastic, which is that you go and see the fortune teller in any disguise, and he stands up and he says, "You're bringing pain to this place. You're an evil person, and you're bringing pain to this place. Leave now, or I will call the police."
He actually says that to everyone. It's just a stick.
Right, no idea. Right, but what I love is that this weird
$20 now leave.
Right, there's this weird implication then that in this world, this fortune teller is real.
Yeah.
Like, he's a real dude who knows what's going on. Which I don't know. I think it's a what a weird game.
It is a weird game.
Remember when that game was announced and everyone was like, "I'm not super stoked about this game," and then it came out. And
I was
like,
excited about the episodic thing because I always wanted them to do that with Blood Money.
So
but I had no faith in them after Absolution because it really felt like they didn't know what was good about
after
their game.
Absolution. So there are a couple of things here. One is that I was excited about episodic stuff because I could sense that they were trying to do something, but I couldn't work out what it was. And it wasn't until Sapienza that I realized, oh shit, I see why this is episodic now. The other thing is, their lead level designer on that game is the game director on Absolution, I believe. So it's interesting that, because the level design in Hitman 2016 is brilliant. It's interesting that I wonder whether or not by putting that guy in a position where he's able to make really amazing levels, but not necessarily make core decisions about what that game should be. I wonder whether or not that's kind of what needed to happen.
Yeah. It's very much a direction choice that ruined Absolution. It was just like they decided it needed to be a long linear story where the objective of each level was not necessarily to kill someone. It was, you know, to progress. And that often meant getting to a door.
Whereas in 2016, they just turned around and fled directly in the opposite direction.
Which I like to think that they, you know, heard some of the complaints about Absolution.
Oh, it's so
and,
good.
Oh, our game should be about killing people. Oh, okay.
We what an amazing game. What a great game. Sorry, Pip. You should play it.
I'll add it to the list.
What you should do, Pip, is tell us about where you've been.
Oh, really?
Where have
I
you
wasn't
been?
Sure.
You can do.
Well, I mean, I went to the League of Legends World Championships finals, but I don't know if that is a thing that people are interested in.
Is that the one with a really amazing stage?
It depends. It was, they used floor projection for the first time that I've seen, and that was interesting because it's something that Valve did with Dota and that a few other tournament organisers have done sort of other things with. And so I would say it was interesting and cool, but at the same time, some of the bits didn't quite make sense. So like they had the screens on, so this was in the Staples Center in LA, and so they had the teams in like what looked like clamshells facing away from each other so that the players wouldn't get distracted by the floor projections or wouldn't be able to like see, you know, what was happening on the screen above or anything like that. So they were in like these weird futuristic clamshell office spaces in front of everybody. And then there were the four screens facing the four different sort of stadium directions, quite high up that you could watch the matches play out on. And then on the floor in the middle, most of the space was just given over to like just an empty white space onto which they projected the game's kind of mini map. And you could then use that to see which turrets were still up and the major map objectives like the Baron and the dragons and things like that. It gave you information, but also there were some animation elements that really worked, like the Baron spawning in, like it's like this little worm-like dragon that spiraled into the thing and then sort of appeared in its space. But then, you know, if the team killed one of those objectives, like if they took down a dragon, then the map would temporarily, like for a few seconds, just get replaced with the outline of the element of dragon that it had been. But it would say, you know, like, dragon killed or something. But so obviously it had one direction that it was legible in, and the three other sides, you know, it wasn't quite the right way up. And they flipped it sort of from one side of the stadium to the opposite side every other match. But it was still a kind of, you didn't need to make this directional.
Right.
And that was a choice. You know, you could have done it in other ways. And also there were numbers on the sides of the map for, you know, the gold that a team had earned and the turrets that had been taken, things like that. And so the numbers were quite hard to read and obviously had a particular direction that you could see them better from. So I think that didn't quite work. And also some of it was really slow. Like someone would take a turret and it would take about, you know, 30 seconds for the floor to update. And I'm like, well...
So surely, going to run onto the floor and draw a new one,
or just like wipe it out. But like, surely, like, because Valve, when they were doing stuff for the international and they had effects that linked to particular events, they just programmed it so that it, you know, once it was registered in the game, it would happen floor. It was instantaneous.
How that works is actually crazy. Like,
but surely, if Riot are going to do that, you don't just have like, and obviously, I don't know how they did it, but at the same time, it felt like. Surely you rig it to connect with the thing that it is.
You don't
measuring.
Just have like Susan waiting in a box to go like bing.
Even if it's Susan, she could respond faster than 30 seconds. Right? Come she's on, watching Susan. The game.
Like, you have I think one the crowd job. Are react literally first. One
Do
job.
Do you think that there's a weird sort of like theatrics arms race taking place in these major tournaments?
I think in some ways, but I also think that it's partly because people are trying to make the information that. Those games tend to need to impart a more accessible.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you are trying to work out who is ahead in a MOBA, you're kind of like, okay, well, how many structures does this side have as compared to this one? And what are their characters like? And what is their scaling as the game goes on? Like, will they sort of drop off in effectiveness or will they increase? And how many items do they have? How many, you know, how much gold do they have? How much this, how much that. And so with that much stuff that can theoretically influence how the game is going, I do really appreciate that it's an ongoing problem trying to make at least some of it a bit more. You know, for example, if someone had been running late that day and had only just got into the Staples Center, you know, I assume that maybe one of the goals for it was that they could look at this big thing on the floor and go, oh, okay, I see that this person's ahead in gold, this person's ahead in kills and turrets and things, and that person has, like, you know, more map control, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As this was this your third waltz? League waltz?
Let me think. It was...
Korea,
yes,
Europe,
yeah.
America.
Yeah, Korea, Berlin.
How is it, like,
LA.
Scaling up? Like, what is the sort of... What is the sense you get with that?
So, it's weird because this is actually the first final that has felt like a final. This is the first final that has felt exciting and like it could... go either way. Whereas the previous ones last year was SKT versus Rocks Tigers, and that was very much a kind of, yeah, this is SKT's game at this point, like really early on it felt like, and it was like, well, you know, the Berlin Stadium is quite nice, so I guess. And also Faker, the like most well-known league player, had said that in sort of tribute to his current fluffy hairstyle, he was going to eat broccoli if they won the next day. So most people were kind of like, okay, well, I guess at least I get to see a man on stage eating some broccoli for some reason.
Esports.
Yeah.
And the game might not be that great, but that's going to be special.
Roly-poly as he came out onto the stage.
Oh, wow.
As well, which is quite fun.
I'm suddenly on board.
But yeah, and those were kind of the more interesting things.
Oh god. Which isn't really what you want, right?
And the previous year it was very much like, oh wow, this is a stomp, because Samsung White were just so much better than, I think it was Stockholm Royal Club, and it was just like, it was one of those like, oh wow, this is so stompy, we'll just be leaving soon. But it ended up going to four games of this best of five. And if you listen to the commentary and things, it's like people saying, oh, maybe they've clawed it back, maybe they'll do the reverse sweep, you know, all of that stuff. And it's like, no, this is kind of like watching a cat toy with a mouse just because it can, and they've picked like nonsense, and it's just like, oh good, Clown Town for a while, and then, oh no, we should probably just win this, okay, we're done. So
this was the first year that it's been seriously competitive in the grand final, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was such a good final. It really was. It had like the kind of the dream arc, I guess, of a final. So I assume that because it will have been pretty much exactly a week when this comes out, I'm okay to sort of spoil it. So SKT won for the third time in the 6 years of the World Championships running, but this was they in the first game, essentially, just to sort of give you a bit of a clue about the teams. SKT have this reputation as, you know, the best team in the world, and I always sort of say they're not infallible, but when they're on form, they are terrifying.
They're more infallible than everyone else.
They're less infallible than everyone else. Hang
less
on,
fallible.
No, hang
less
on,
fallible. More infallible.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry, that really confused me.
It's Tobias Reaper, the king of the...
But yeah, so, and so they can be taken down, you know, like a few, but they're also like, their, coach is really smart and makes really smart drafting decisions when picking the actual champion lineups and things like that. And, the players themselves, like some of them have amazing synergy, some slightly less so. And that's kind of notable, but it's notable because the team's overall standard is so high. So you start sort of seeing sort of cracks where in another team that person would be like the best. And so that's kind of their reputation, and they have, you know, they don't necessarily always win best of fives 3-0, but they do sort of, when they make mistakes, they learn from them and they can kind of really pull it back and be reactive and punish mistakes and things like that. So they'll sort of strangle you out of a game. And their opponents were Samsung Galaxy, and they're kind of like this not upstart team, but they... So Samsung had this thing a while back where, like, there were loads of teams in the Korean league, domestic league, and then there was a rule change where organizations weren't allowed to field more than one team in the league. And so the situation that had happened in 2014, which was that Samsung White and Samsung Blue had both made it to Worlds, couldn't happen again. And, you know, like, basically everyone had two teams. And so they had to collapse them into one team, but then in doing so kind of ended up just purging the entire roster. So it's not the same team that has been around for a while, and Samsung is very much more an established team. So it was kind of one of those, oh wow, okay, these guys really haven't been on my radar, and now they've sort of rocked up at Worlds and they've made it all the way through to the grand final, and oh okay. But they'd been on the easier side of the tournament bracket, so everyone was a bit like, oh yeah, but they, you know, probably won't be as good, and they'll probably just get like their asses handed to them, and it might go to like four games, but you know, SKT have kind of got this. So anyway, that's all of the kind of preamble, I guess. And then the first game, it was a lot closer than I think pretty much everyone had thought it would be, but ultimately, Samsung had lost slightly too much too early to be able to claw it back in the later portion of the game, despite sort of being able to keep SKT at bay for a whole bunch of time. So it was kind of tense, but sort of, oh, okay, well, SKT is still winning, so, you know, no big surprises there. And then the second game, it kind of felt like Samsung had fallen apart a bit and just sort of really weren't pulling anything exciting out and couldn't hold their own, and it was a much sort of more decisive victory in SKT's kind of favor, I think, if memory serves. And then in game three, it looked like it was pretty much over. Like, I think I saw a few people actually leaving because it was just like, oh, okay, fine. And it was like, Samsung were just doing sort of clean, kind of just taking you apart, taking you apart, taking you apart. And I was basically like, you know, you're kind of getting ready for the press conference and getting, you know, like, okay, have I got all my things? You know, all of that kind of thing. Oh God, how to make this sound interesting for like the umpteenth time I've had to write about Samsung winning a thing, SKT winning a thing. And then like Samsung were just holding it together. And I was like, okay. And then they started clawing it back. And you're just like, huh, okay. And then they, essentially, as the game had gone on, they had been taking the dragon objective, which is early on in the game, these things spawn like every few minutes that are related to a particular element. Like, you've got a mountain drake and you've got a cloud drake and an ocean drake and a infernal drake, of all the dramatic names. And they each bestow different buffs that can't be taken away from you. And then once they stop spawning in the later game, you get an elder drake that takes more trouble to kill if you've been stacking up the early ones, but it gives a real boost to the buffs that you've got from those early ones. And so because Samsung had been sort of stacking those up, they had actually some way back into the game, so they could kill the Elder Drake, get their buffs kind of beefed up, and then sort of start making inroads against SKT. And so that's kind of part of how they got back into the game. There were also a whole bunch of fights around the other big objective called the Baron. And the, like, at one point, I honestly just wasn't sure if I was watching replays or another fight in that same area. Cause it was just like, okay, I think this fight's been going on for 6 minutes somehow. Like, it just keeps going. They're just moving, they're resetting, they're going back in, they're doing like all of this stuff. And eventually they actually managed to pull it off. And they won the game. And by league standards, it was a really long one. I think it was like 70 minutes or something.
71 minutes, I believe.
And so I was kind of like, mate, you think that's long? You want to see this 3-hour Dota nonsense? But then I was like, actually, no, no one wants to see that. That was awful.
We were all in that room.
Miserable.
It was a strange time.
And so, no, I was on a pub crawl and I think it was still going by the time I got back. I was like, oh, for God's sake. And then the fourth game, they actually won pretty handily. And it was like, okay, is this the reverse sweep? You know, like, is this how they finally dethrone, I guess, the best team in the world? I don't know. I've put that in quote marks.
Because they've won.
Because it's kind of what everyone thinks. And what they repeatedly demonstrate. And then everyone got really excited because it was like, oh, Silver Scrapes, which is like this interminable piece of basically League of Legends hold music that plays like in the gap between games 4 and 5 of a best of 5 series. And the worst thing about that was they played it just like normal and everyone was like excited and like put their phone like flashlights on and were like waving them around. Like,
that's the nerdiest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, well,
it's like the 7th inning stretch in baseball.
Or like a really emotional song at like a concert, you know?
It's amazing.
Like lighters in the air. But the most annoying thing about it was that it clearly got into the head of the guy who was sat like next to me, and he insisted on like whistling it in bursts all throughout the fifth game, but he couldn't remember how the second phrase of it went, and it was ever so slightly off key.
Wow.
And I hate whistling at the best of times, and so it was just like making my spine actually crawl, and I was going to hit him if it had
with a selfie stick.
That would have been good, wouldn't it? That would have been murder, and I would have been
that would be death murder
to leave the country
with an iPhone flashlight.
Yeah.
And then the fifth game was like, okay, ended up going to SKT, and like it was that kind of thing where they were playing really fluidly and well, and it felt like that was where maybe Samsung's inexperience kicked in, because, like, you know how you get a feel for people's mood just from the style of play that they're doing? So SKT were kind of like confident making decisions and just sort of the game was flowing, whereas it felt like Samsung was sort of fighting the flow of the game constantly, like always maybe not quite making the right decision, maybe kind of trying to force things, maybe like just really desperate not to let the win kind of get out of their hands, and in doing so losing it by degrees.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of heartbreaking in that respect, but I was so glad to feel like SKT deserved it rather than just having a 3-0 stomp and just go, eh, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Samsung, like, players, like, there were some amazing plays in that and some, you know, real kind of resilience that came through. And I sort of think that they acquitted themselves really well, especially given that people were like, you know, okay, well, I guess at least they're just happy to be here kind of thing. Yeah. And it's like, no, they really, really want this. And so that was, like, there was an amazing Baron steal where Ambition, one of the jungler for Samsung, kind of goes in at the very last minute and gets the last hit on the Baron objective and takes that buff for their team. So it's like stuff like that was actually really exciting to watch and really cool. And there's like a gifting the rounds of the casters in that match, like properly losing it.
I'm
at
just
that
jump up and down.
Yeah, like, yeah. There's Quickshot is just absolutely beside himself. So I really love the caster cam, actually, like, because they do all get really into it. It's really cool. But yeah, so I guess that was my Saturday. Yeah.
Wait, what day is it today?
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
So yeah. You were in LA on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
People back yesterday. Light.
A little bit.
What time do you think it is right now?
Mate, I don't know. The lights are off. We've got Halloween candles. I think it's I've just had breakfast. Who knows?
Your breakfast was an old fashioned. It just, I don't know. Have you experienced this by now? It's just sugar past a certain point.
Oh, no, mine's all right. Like, mine's a... So you guys, I kind of like peeled your orange peel with a knife, because when I did it for mine with a peeler, it just disintegrated into a kind of tiny little fragments of orange peel. And so I just got that, and that probably has sugar in it, but I'm not drinking
That's
it.
That's not so bad. Oh, but like, I don't know, I always joke when I'm watching like sports or Eurovision. Mostly the World Cup.
Eurovision is sports. Don't take that away.
Oh, my God. It's absolutely
if esports
sports.
Are sports, Eurovision is sports.
No, Eurovision is
sports. Bake Off is sports.
Bake Off is sports. Right, totally. So what I'm essentially...
Euro Bake Off.
Oh God. Don't let the Americans be in Bake Off.
No, because we've left Europe.
What I'm essentially...
Oh, man, they're doing it without us now.
What I realize that I'm essentially cheering for in the World Cup is sport as a concept.
You were the one guy at the back going, yes, sport!
I don't really care who wins. I just really want it to be the most absurd sport I've ever seen. Mm. And so definitely with something like Worlds, and I've seen this with the International before, like, I don't know. Stomps are kind of narratively interesting to a certain extent, but what I really want to see is just like, I don't know, it's the privilege of someone who doesn't have a favorite team, right? Mm. Is to be able to go in there and just go like, I just want to see some bullshit happen for hours.
I mean, I have teams that I'm fond of and that I would sort of prefer to see do well in any given matchup, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But it's more because I like their play style, or I think that they've sort of... in for whatever reason deserve it because, you know, blah, 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 because they've worked hard or because it's more interesting narratively or whatever else. And 3-0s can be interesting, or they can be a lot more hard fought than that scoreline suggests. And they can have interesting things happening in amongst them. But I think it's harder to... if you don't know all of the narratives beforehand. Like, you can plug it into those if you've...
Right.
kept up with the scene, or if you've kept up with the domestic leagues or whatever, and you're like, oh, okay, that's really interesting for these reasons, or because these things got picked or whatever else. But I think that somebody coming to the game, maybe who hasn't kept up with that stuff, or maybe who only watches once a year, or who's even just watching with friends, or usually watches Dota or something, like, they're gonna look at it and won't have any of that context. So a best of five that goes to a full five is sort of more narratively satisfying as a contained thing.
Yeah. Mm. There's like a StarCraft. An individual story.
Mm.
There's a StarCraft player who's just known for inventing things. I can't remember what his name is. No, but it's a Zerg. and it's not like mega successful. He doesn't win a lot of tournaments, but when he plays, everyone's kind of on tenterhooks because there's a decent chance he's just going to do something no one's ever done before. Mm. And the last game I saw of his, like, he was playing a Zerg where you have to like make creep to put buildings on, and creep is also like gives you vision and it's a good thing to have anyway, but no one really uses it that much outside of their base. And he just kind of created this mass of queens and created this creep highway to the enemy base and kept putting spine crawlers on it, and loads and loads of spine crawlers, which are like static defense, except they can uproot and move to somewhere new, and they're really powerful, but they take a long time to root. And it's one of those things where, like, everyone knows in theory you could do that, but no one does it because it doesn't work. And then yeah. This guy just makes it work and just destroys the enemy. And everyone's like, the competition is going absolutely insane and just saying, like, if you play StarCraft on the ladder tonight against a Zerg, you are going to see this happen to you.
Yeah.
Well, there was an interesting moment in the, just after the Bangkok level in Hitman was launched, where it became clear that a certain sniper rifle that had been in the game from the beginning could penetrate geometry. And the game had logical geometry. Like, it was designed to do this. I don't think it was designed to do this quite to the extent that it did, but it was really fascinating that at no point the game had communicated that this was a way to use this weapon.
There's a little icon on one of those sniper rifles that has, like, they're all really cryptic, but like...
Oh, they are super cryptic. And that's got to be deliberate, right?
There is one that looks like it's penetrating something. There's a line and something going through the line, and I wonder if that's what that meant.
Well, right, but I mean...
Kills lines, Tom.
See any stick men, shoot it with this.
A kind of famous video doing the rounds in which someone completed that Bangkok level by doing some real bullshit with the geometry and the sniper rifle. Like, firing up into the corner of rooms to shoot, like, down a perfect line to the room on the other side of the hotel or whatever. IO saw this, and they were like, yeah, we meant to do this with this gun, but we didn't quite mean to do it like that. So they toned it down a little once they'd seen that someone could do that. But it was really interesting from a sort of game design perspective that you would put something like that in the game, that you would contribute to the conversation in the game in that way, silently. You'd say, we're adding this gun that does this thing, but we're just not going to tell anybody that it does it. Let people find that out, which I thought was really interesting.
Takotsu was having a... I mean, all games have a metagame, that's the thing.
Like, right.
And it's about what people are aware of, it's whether or not developers support it. I saw a tweet by, I think, a reasonably prominent Hitman YouTube, it might even be the guy you're talking about, who said, you know, it's glad to know that IO are watching, and it was just two tweets by him of like, hey, I've killed this guy in this way, and then immediately both of them followed by patch notes like several days later saying like, this can no longer do that. And there's this one guy who's responsible for the developer kind of stepping in and steering things away from whatever particular bit of interaction he's exploiting.
The best change they made in response to player feedback, and I like to think it was my player feedback, was that the going upstairs icon used to be a left arrow next to some stairs, and the going downstairs was a right arrow next to some stairs, and it was profoundly unclear.
Is it now up and down?
Now it's up and down, yeah.
They patched that? Yeah. Because I remember seeing you complain about that, but I somehow didn't even notice that whatsoever.
Left the direction of down, and right the direction of up.
What I really like about Hitman's maps is that they are so... they're so useless. They're so uncommunicative in so many ways until you need them to be useful, and then you look at them and you're like, oh, I see. Because, like, every level I've started playing and I've looked at the map, they have not corresponded with what my final mental picture of that level is at all. But when I need to find where, like, a disguise is or where stairs are or something, you know, that's the thing to go to. It's a strange miscommunication between the UI and what's actually in the level.
What have you been playing this week? Tom, appreciate that we've had a long what we've been playing.
mostly Titanfall, so we've already talked about that. Mm-hmm. But I also played Battlefield 1, and I thought the intro to that was really, really slick and amazing. I'm so used to games just starting with like, all right, recruit, here's how you duck, and aim down your sights. And...
that is war. I'd be so disappointed if I ever get conscripted to fight in World War III, which will probably start next week, so that's fine. And that's not the first part of point in training.
But yeah, it's a kind of very cinematic and also technically brilliant. Like, you're playing one part of it, and when you die, the camera just pulls over to the next part of it just seamlessly. And that's like great both cinematically and also like really good for tutorial, because... like, I don't actually know how it works if you're someone who does struggle with first-person shooters or if you've never played one before, because usually that's who I feel like tutorials are aimed at. And this time, for once, I was never frustrated and never stopped and never irritated. I just play an interesting bit of an interesting scene in which I'm doing one thing, and then if I die, I just move on to a scene where I'm doing a different thing.
Is that really who you think that those tutorials are aimed at? Because
when they tell you to duck, yeah.
Okay, because I assume that they're just familiarizing people who like first-person shooters with the buttons.
Yeah, like to some extent, but then it's always.
Because I never feel primed to play the game after that. Like, I never feel like, oh, okay, I'm good at these things now. It's like, okay, well, I've got a jumble of buttons that I theoretically know what to use.
Yeah.
Bye, I guess.
Yeah, Battlefield, it's like so much of it is super familiar that I didn't need any kind of induction to that. And so it was just great to have a really slick intro. I'd be really interested to know how it works to someone who has never played a Battlefield game or never played like a shooter of this kind. I assume with a game of that budget, they must have tested it a bunch, and presumably it works. Anyway, like after that, that's really slick and really quick. My two favorite features of a tutorial. The rest of the campaign is split up into little mini campaigns, and you get to choose which one you do. And one of them is, be a Bedouin guerrilla soldier woman helping out Lawrence of Arabia taking out the Ottoman Empire by stealth with a horse and a knife. I'm like, oh my god, this is incredible. Like, this is exactly what I want. And it's only three missions, but they're really good, and they're stealth missions, and they're very like you said the other week, Chris, are very like Far Cry-esque. First thing it tells you to do is like use your binoculars to tag enemies, and then sneak up on them with a knife. And so there's that, and then there's the one of the campaigns is kind of about a tank, and although it does feature the tank heavily, actually a lot of it is stealth as well. Probably more of it is stealth than tank.
It's about 50-50 stealth and tank.
All right, yep. and that one also features the thing you were talking about where you have to get these four spark plugs from these four different camps, and it's just this huge open area, and it's totally up to you how you go about it, and there are horses, and there are
sniper
rifles,
plugs.
And there are silenced weapons, and there are knives, and decent stealth systems. There are alarms that you can disable ahead of time, and it's properly vast, like even bigger than, like, there's no Far Cry outpost that's this big. This is four Far Cry outposts on a Far Cry map, and you just, whole thing is that. But all of this stuff is because the campaigns are so short, and because they don't know what order you're going to do them in, they are kind of, difficulty-wise, like entry-level. They have to be fairly easy, because they can't expect you to be an expert at this yet. And the interesting side effect of that for me was that I just decided to just roll with whatever happened. Like, I disabled all my perfectionist instincts, and if I got caught, I would just fight. Like, the very first mission with the Lawrence of Arabia section, I snuck in and I killed like three people with a knife perfectly, and then as I was killing the fourth, I kind of misjudged it, and the guy was too close to him and I heard it and turned around and attacked me, and I picked up an AMI machine gun and just turned it into a gunfight and won that, and then and carried on. And then for like the spark plug mission, which doesn't make it sound that great when you call it that, but it was just kind of amazing because I just rolled with everything. Like, the first camp I was at, I snuck through it and I was trying to take out these guys. Had a good sniper rifle, but only had limited ammo for it. And it was silence. I was coming up to them, and for some reason I had it in my head there were three spark plugs, and I could see on my map there was three objectives that weren't here. So I thought, okay, there isn't one here. I'll just move on. There was a kind of circle around me, and I thought that looked like an objective thing, but I could see, oh no, the three objectives were over there. I'll carry on to them. Later it turns out there was a spark plug there. It was telling me that there was a spark plug there. But I thought, well, if I don't have to kill these people, I'll just slip by them. Great. And then moved on to the next camp. And then in the next camp, spent ages like crawling on my belly up to these two guys near a campfire. And there's a third guy patrolling near enough to them that I feel like if I took them out, he would see or react. But he's behind a bunch of wooden planks, and I wasn't quite sure if my sniper rifle would penetrate that. I'm trying to think, can I take out these three people? Do I know for sure my bullet will go through these planks? I decide to try it, and as I'm deciding that, someone else starts to see me, and I don't see where they are, and so I panic, and I shoot at the two guys in front of the campfire, and just by a pure serendipity. My bullet goes through both of them and kills them with one shot. And then I spin around to where I know the guy with the planks is, and I shoot him through the planks, and that works too. And I'm thinking, fucking brilliant. And then the guy who actually saw me, who I still haven't figured out where he is yet, finally spin around and find him. And I shoot him just as he's starting to say the alarm words or whatever they are.
There's somebody.
And it feels absolutely perfect, but it counts as an alarm. Like that guy, whatever he was doing, like it triggered the
He was alarmed, even if he didn't set off an alarm.
And so I haven't, like, this is my second camp. I haven't looked at anything else yet. I was just kind of scouting it out. And so I haven't disabled any alarm panels. So, like, people are running to those alarm panels. Everyone's yelling. Everything goes absolutely crazy. And so I just sprint for the hills and hide. And then just, because it's such a huge map, just skirt my way around to one of the others. And I realize, like, reinforcements are coming in trucks and they're unloading and stuff. But everyone has gone to the place where they heard a guy yell alarm. And so all the other camps are almost deserted. And I just sneak through, like, killing those guys. And eventually, like... get those two spark plugs. I know I've left one back at the start, and so I steal a horse and I ride all the way around the outskirts of the map. My horse is fast, but not mega stealthy. But because it's so fast, you can afford to take a really long route. And ride all the way back to the original camp and take those guys out, take the last spark plug, and then like ride back to the rest of my tank crew waiting by the tank with my sword drawn.
Exactly the same thing.
Like, here I am, bitches. I did it.
I still love that whole section starts with just like, oh, I'm just a regular chauffeur, not ready for the Ward-Wendell wars. Anyway, I just killed 60 Germans and I've stolen a horse.
Yeah.
I don't think I know how to steal a horse.
No, you befriend a horse.
They're pretty neutral, the horses.
Well, but my friend...
they're like Switzerland.
When I was a kid, I grew up in the countryside, my friend Charlie would jump on the backs of horses without a saddle and ride them for a bit, and I never quite understood how he managed to do that. And so,
you press E. You walk
up to them and you press E, you hold it down. Come the war, I won't be the sort of person who steals a horse.
I don't think we'll have a horse in our war.
I don't know, when was the last time you saw a horse? Oh. IRL.
Fuck, I don't know.
I usually chat to them online, so...
Right, you know, it's like 23M
horse.
You saw a horse a couple of weeks ago?
I tend to go on nature walks.
I've been enjoying your good Twitter insects and things, and flowers and things. They've been very good.
I saw one on the 28th of September. I saw two on the
28th of
September.
It's the day before my birthday.
That's my birthday.
Wait, really?
Yeah, that's why I saw one.
You had a birthday horse?
Not because of my birthday, but I was on a cycle ride for my birthday, and that's when I saw the horse, and that's why I
What was it doing? Did you go and say hi?
It was one... there were two horses, and they were drawing a carriage. And
holy
they
shit!
Were, going past an extremely fancy hotel.
Ah, oh, the Queen was there.
So they were busy. You were interrupting.
I didn't do anything to them. I just saw them.
His birthday, he's allowed to interrupt.
Anytime you see,
I didn't interrupt the horses.
It's like where the flag is. Anytime you see more than one horse drawing a carriage, that means the Queen's in it. So she was there.
Is the Queen the flag in this giant CTF game we're playing?
Right, you capture the Queen and you take her back to,
back to your country.
If they get your Queen, then you have to wait till they've returned your Queen.
It's no good returning their Queen to your country if your Queen's gone.
Smack them together, you don't get any points.
Oh, it's amazing.
Sword in chess and CTF. Yeah.
Titanfall's got really good CTF. If you want to loop this all the way back.
What's the F?
Flag.
No, I mean, in Titanfall, is it still a flag?
No, well, it's a flag.
Because in TF2, I always liked that it was just like, weird box.
Briefcase,
flag.
Right?
A flag in Titanfall.
It's a flag, yeah.
Yeah, okay. They could do better than that. I think smaller Titan.
I remember in Jedi Knight, sure. It was called Capture, and you can correct me on the pronunciation of this, Chris, the Isilimari?
Isilimari.
Isilimari.
What is that?
It's a force-negating lizard.
I'm sorry?
It's a sort of like a reptile, sort of amphibian, sort of salamander creature thing.
No. How big is it?
It's like, I don't know.
You can capture it.
Bigger than a... It's like, yeah, it's like a, I don't know, like sort of like a big iguana.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And what to the force?
It negates the force.
In what way?
It nullifies
it. It eats all the midichlorians.
You can't jump.
But the midichlorians went around when Timothy Zahn wrote his Thrawn trilogy and used the Isilimari as a weapon to be used against the Jedi. They nullify
What's the animation?
So what, do they just like sit on a Jedi and like
no, they're just
great question.
Make him not
they
able to
out.
Do like brain
I'm not,
fuckery?
Look, we're deep into this podcast, and to be honest, if I knew, I'd be here defending the Star Wars Expanded Universe.
So what happens,
I wouldn't have drunk as much as
What happens if the lizard is away from the Force, is it therefore like just has no effect?
Yeah.
Or does it actually warp things so far in the opposite direction? Like, has he just got like a negative ionization force field around it's it like the entire time?
Yeah. How do we find this out?
So like
Wikipedia.
So no. So how does the Force know where the lizards are?
Well,
so it can't, because like the Force is supposed to be this thing that runs through everything, because it's kind of like secret life.
It binds
Jesus
us all together, except the
it is secret life,
like,
Jesus energy.
So hang
yeah.
on, no. So do the lizards sit outside the universe?
Pretty much.
That's
they're about this big. How many of them are there?
There's several.
What color are they?
In Jedi Knight, they were very small and yellow. They looked like a bit like a maggot, and it would like hover in front of you, and then you grabbed it, and
it
then
floats.
It was true that when you had it, you couldn't use your Force powers.
So what's the animation on this?
Who do they talk to?
When you capture the
in Jedi Knight,
the lizard.
I don't remember, but it was...
Is it just someone running around with this lizard, like, flopping on
no,
the
it's very small. I think it's almost, like, theoretical once you have it. It's just
it's a
like,
theoretical lizard. Great.
You conceptually have the Silmarillion, and you can't use the Force powers.
How close does it have
maybe
to be?
Blow.
What's its radius?
It's been a long time since the 90s.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, and I only saw it, like, once, I think. But I remember it as a floating yellow maggot in a, like a little aura, like it had a little glowing thing, and it was literally hovering in space.
But
until
so
you walk
can
up and touch it,
these
and
Force
yours.
People
Jedi.
Sense? Can they sense where the lizards are by how empty the Force is?
That wasn't a mechanic in the game.
Because otherwise, right, you'd be on the bus and then
I mean, it's in the enemy base.
Drive
the Jedi bus.
Past the lizard house and then you wouldn't be able to read the future anymore, right?
You go like, oh shit, there's lizards around.
So, like,
it's, yeah, it's like when you lose
know.
Your 3G. You know,
yeah.
It's like you're refreshing Twitter
you're
and it
H.
stops working.
You don't
it's
know like, what you're doing.
It's like going through a tunnel while on the phone.
Yeah.
But except you're on the phone to, I don't know, to the
to
Force.
God.
Yeah. But that's what Jedis are, right?
Right.
They?
Right.
They're just like permanently like some look, weird radio.
As I say, I wasn't ready for this.
This means that instead of looking at your phone and going like, oh, no signal, you just go like, sometimes you just
lizard.
Go like, oh, lizards.
Oh, but you'd like, so if you can use the Force to just see what everyone's doing... Like,
that's not how it works, sure.
But it is.
No, it's not.
You use the Force to sense what's going on,
no,
right?
Well,
Jedi
really.
Steven can see the Force everywhere.
There's not like a lot of looking into the future, really.
But no, I'm looking into the present. You could tell whether people were lying about their Twitter updates. You could tell whether they were like sort of social lies.
You can't see through space and time to the other side of the world or anything. That's
but then what's the point of the Force?
Or
like,
the lizards.
How did he sense...
Force push.
Right. How did Obi-Wan Kenobi sense a great disturbance in the Force if he wasn't doing that nonsense?
No, because it was such a... God, I can't believe we're having this discussion.
There's a lot of people
podcast about this specific thing, Pip.
But we didn't cover this.
Okay, fine. It's because there's such a tremendous loss of life in a certain moment that the Force itself is wounded.
Does
if
there had
been a lizard
it?
On the planet, would it have stopped?
Yeah.
If there had been a lizard on the Millennium Falcon at the time, yes.
Could you put lizards in orbit around the planet that
you'd need loads.
The Death
you'd
Star
need so many.
On, and then, like, cloak it. It's a
cloak
like,
one Death Star destroys the planet, one Death Star fires the lizards.
I'm not sure.
Dream.
The way to do this would be to put a lizard on every Jedi at the same time.
So, but...
This is your lizard.
So, yeah. How...
Hey, pet
so,
this lizard. No reason.
If you had a lizard, you could do surprises. For Jedi.
It'd be a lot like, yeah, yes. So basically
so
what
like,
Blizzard
play
needs
tricks on them.
To do a long callback to the beginning
oh,
of this podcast.
Yes,
what Blizzard
they
needs
need a lizard. They need a
blizzard,
blizzard
lizard.
The Blizzard lizard. The Blizzard lizard that stops you detecting the Args.
Yeah.
Feel the Args, Luke.
Oh, God. The Blizzard lizard that stops you detecting the Args.
Binders
it was so obvious.
I feel like that's definitely the name of the podcast. Okay, well, we can pick this up later.
The real...
Because I have more questions.
The real Blizzard Lizard was the friends we made along the way. Oh, Jesus.
Shall we do questions?
Yes.
Question time.
Question time. I have to rotate awkwardly and switch to the notepad window with the questions in it.
The lights are on now.
The lights are on now. We can see what we're doing.
Just to give readers the sense of the scene.
Yeah, indeed. Just like a radio play. Thomas writes, And I should also say before we begin, we're going to try and rapid fire through questions to try and get as many answers as possible, simply because we've talked for so long already.
Mm-hmm.
And the flapjacks are kicking in.
Oh, yeah.
Thomas writes, last week you commented on the drudging complexity of Civ 6/4X. That is a complicated thing to read.
Civ 6/4X.
Civ 6/4X.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe it's 6/4.
Yeah, it's 6 divided one and by a 4 half. X.
1.5X.
Div 6 four times.
Explore X.
Civ... yeah. What elements of the genre would you most like to see excised or pared down? Does 4X as a genre necessarily preclude a certain level of simplicity? He says. If you abstract too much, is it no longer 4X?
I intend to find out. I'm like, when Civ the Alien 1 came out, I was disappointed by it, and I thought, instead of playing this game, I'm going to make a game that is a 4X game, but just strip out everything I don't care about. And my game would merge things like money and production. They would be the same thing. You just have one kind of building, it produces money, and when you have enough money, you buy the thing. And it would merge things like happiness, population growth, appeal, religion, and culture. All those things would be just one thing. And so it basically boiled down to like four things, and it's basically science, money, army, and people. Like army being military, just like defense and
science, money, army, people is my favorite REM album.
So good.
I could call the game that. And so I'm like kind of working on that in the background, and I have like a design doc that is fairly fleshed out, and I have a Unity project that is not at all fleshed out.
Spam.
Science, people, army, money. Yeah.
Holy spam. Shit.
Nice.
Or maps.
Or maps.
Do you have a name for this?
Amps.
Maps.
Maps. It's a good name.
I was thinking about I also have no, like, I don't want to make like a realistic looking game because it's too hard. So I want to make a totally abstract kind of thing. And I'm imagining like these big transparent kind of columns being the buildings. And you can see how high tech someone is in money by how tall their yellow buildings are, and how, if they have really low red buildings, they're really low in military. And so they'd be like semi-transparent. So I'm thinking about calling it clear cities, because it's also that's about really making it really clear what everything, what's going on.
It's a pun. Or play on words.
Perhaps.
I was thinking about...
But now, like, spam.
when I started thinking about this question, I was thinking about how, in order to get rid of a lot of what I dislike or find uninteresting about 4X games, I'd probably just script them really heavily and just tell a really tight, constricted story about 1 to 5 cities and one country and introduce all these various options. And then as I thought about it more, I realized that what I'm essentially thinking about is the game King of Dragon Pass. Which is in a lot of ways a 4X game. It's a game about exploring the community around you. It's a game about founding your religion. It's a game about developing your economy and forwarding your armies. King of Dragon Pass is this weird,
it's the hardest game to understand if you just hear people describing it, because apparently it's everything. It just does everything all the time.
Have you played it?
No.
Oh my god, King of Dragon Pass is so good. Okay, here's how I will pitch King of Dragon Pass succinctly. It is a game about assembling a council of 6 people who each have their own realistic intentions and goals, and then trying to govern a small community while trying to manage these 6 people. And it's amazing. And it's essentially, I think, what I like out of 4X games, which is getting a sense of who I am in the world, getting a sense of what I want me and my culture to be, and trying very hard to get there, and all the weird obstacles along the way.
Hmm. I've paused slightly too long.
Oh, no.
Making this weird.
We've stymied ourselves.
Indeed.
What more questions do we have?
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for giving me time to rotate to the angle from which I can see the window.
Why don't you move your microphone slightly?
Yeah, that'd be good. Your pop shield is causing you real trouble.
It's... I can't. Next. Zed writes, from 4X to Zed.
Wait, what? Did he write that?
No, we missed Y.
No, that's fine. I thought you were saying that was how he'd started his letter, and I thought, how did he know?
No, he didn't. I said that. It was a segue.
Okay.
Think. Which games, he writes, and this is a good question, so I apologise for fucking this up as badly and in such an ongoing way. Which games, he said, writes, should take themselves more seriously? Which games would benefit from a lighter touch?
I think Viva Pinata should grow the fuck up.
Did you just steal Pip's joke?
No, that was my joke.
Oh.
Pip, Viva it Pinata was yours.
No, it was.
I'm sorry.
Do you want to make the joke again?
No, it's okay.
I just saw that look in Pip's Viva Pinata. I didn't realize you actually said that. Yeah.
I just saw the look in Pip's eyes. That was straight through affronted to Book of Grudges.
Oh, shit.
When Pip finally rides to the last battle on her grudge throne.
It's more of a burn book.
It is, yeah. It goes between Mean Girls and Total War.
I was self-conscious saying it because I was like, man, is this going to seem dumb because I said this in the break as well?
But you didn't. She did.
I did say it in the break. I did for sure say it in the break. I didn't know Pip had already said it in the break.
I think the closest to serious answer at this point is like every fucking game needs to take itself less seriously.
Yeah, every game needs to take itself less seriously. Actually, in some ways, taking itself more seriously is actually a harder question to answer. Because right. You could say, yeah, sure. I mean, I've said many, many, many times, so many military games I'd love to see become silly action movies rather than try and tell us something real about just World War One things. But in terms of games that could do with taking maybe themselves more seriously, it's harder to pin down quite what that might be.
I just recently started replaying Gears 1. Don't do that.
It's great. Why would you not do that?
It's not very good.
It's... We're never going to disagree about waist-high walls and the men who crouch behind them.
In an interview before Gears of War 1 came out, Cliff Bleszinski, that's his name, right?
Yeah. Mm.
That man. I don't...
Clifford, I think, but yeah, sure.
Clifford Bleszinski.
Cliffy B.
Said that he wanted to make Band of Brothers in space. And if you've ever played Gears of War 1, that is not the game he made. He made a game in which people say, piss, the general's going. And then you have to go and follow the general for 6 hours?
I don't remember a lot about Band of Brothers, but I'm pretty sure that happens.
Do you think that Lawbreakers is him trying, having another crack at
oh,
that?
Oh, God. Did you see the interview with Lawbreakers where he was basically like, God, it was so frustrating to me. He gave an interview with Lawbreakers where he was like, all these games have been getting, like, colourful and fun lately, and I want to go back to, like, gritty. And you're like, Cliff, come on, Cliff, we've been working so hard to do the opposite of what you just said. Cliff.
Too many colours. Stop
always,
it.
Cliff.
Too much purple.
I've got a soft spot for Cliff, I've got to say.
I do not have a spot for Cliff.
It's been no spot for Cliff.
No spot for Cliff. Cliff is...
You're Cliff like is, Holland.
No...
Nice.
No spot for Cliff. I will go on the record saying Cliff is done and better designers should replace him.
Oh, I don't know. Gears is a musical. Gears is a musical about chainsaws. It's the biggest, stupidest thing, but it knows what it is. And, you know, there's basically a fucking dance number in the second game called They're Using a Giant Worm. And they are, and it's wonderful. Isn't it?
Right, but I'd much rather see a musical about men with chainsaws made by somebody other than Cliff.
Oh,
Cliff loves spikes.
He loves spikes.
I don't love spikes.
You can't make a musical about chainsaws without including a few spikes.
No, that's
my dad
actually,
told me that.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a good and fair point. But I don't know. I think that like
is that what Hamilton is?
I don't think so.
No, that's about
is that
presidents.
Why it's become
that's about
so,
presidents.
So famous. And
there's no chainsaws.
It's just there's
in
chainsaws, there's spikes. People love it.
Yeah. Aaron Burr, sir, and then he gets bisected by a chainsaw. I don't know. I think brevity and levity are both needed in every AAA game that has been made. And from what you've been saying, Titanfall 2 seems to be
Titanfall's
doing pretty
got a little
well
bit of bants. It's got some bants. It's not
Assassin's
like
Creed could lighten the fuck up.
Yeah, this is the thing. Games that should lighten up. That's a really easy question because it is most of them.
Yeah.
Games that need to take things more seriously is harder.
Battlefield.
Like, what? Really?
Mm.
Yes. I don't think Battlefield
takes it so seriously.
No, but I think it needs to take itself more seriously, which is I think that I feel that often games about war tend to lean into a sort of hypermasculinity rather than a sort of I feel that games about these situations could tend to be a lot more emotive. And a lot more viscerally emotive.
But it tries as hard as it can, and it can't escape its systems.
Right, so. But I think the answer there is that they need to hire better writers.
I don't think it's a writing question. I think it's a systems question. I don't think you can have, like, I don't think, like, hot swapping your Sten gun for your bro's Sten gun before killing some Germans is ever going to be something that lends itself to a meaningful exploration of that war. If anything, making it sillier would probably make it more effective.
Possibly.
I don't know. I don't see they get more serious without making it a very different game.
That's true. There's a great moment in the very beginning of Titanfall 2, right, where you land on the planet and it's just fucking chaos around you constantly, and everybody's screaming, and then you take four steps forward and get hit by a falling Titan.
Yeah, yeah.
And
then menaced by an alien dog.
Yeah, an alien dog shows up at that point.
That's what Battlefield 1 could have done with.
Yeah.
An alien dog.
Much like in Band of Brothers. I don't know. I'm still trying to think of a game that needs to take itself more seriously, but not in a way that would make it a different game.
I think that the people who made the Assassin's Creed Partwork magazine should have taken their work more seriously.
Yeah.
The Assassin's Creed what?
There's an Assassin's Creed Partwork magazine where you collect, like, the figurines and you subscribe to, like, the issues, and it tells you stuff about, I don't know, like, the Borgias or whatever, or the Pope, or various
what
things.
What can I collect for the Pope?
So, you get, like, so if you subscribed at the point where it started, you got, like, you got a reduction in the cost of the thing, I think.
Great.
But you also got gifts worth, and I use the word worth with so many caveats, a certain amount of money, and it was just stuff like, oh, you get an Assassin's Creed branded belt and, like, all of that kind of stuff. And I'm like, surely if they were a secret organization, you don't want to just go, like, branding. Like,
big on branding.
What is that? Mm. But, you know, but they also had, like, these little figurines that you collect, and they are kind of, you know, in that, like, little model vein with, like, a stand that you at some point get as part of the thing, and you can stand them on it,
they
and
fall
it's
over
all a bit
prior to that point.
Oh god, they're so bad. They are really bad. And they're, like, kind of not supposed to be. They're like, oh, these wonderful handcrafted miniatures, and you're kind of like, whoa, okay. And, like, they're just, like, staring at you boss-eyed, and you're going, and I kind of, it was so bad from the, like, the sales page that I was going to get it, because I have no sense when it comes to that stuff. I'm like, oh, I'm now in love with this. It's gone so far beyond awful into, oh god, that I now need to own every single part of it. And it was only because I actually stood up and put my credit card in the other room that I did not buy this.
I was looking at Titanfall figurines.
I don't know
them today. Well, okay, I'm about to give you a number, a money number.
Okay,
$400.
What?
No.
I'd expect an actual Titan for that.
For $400?
Yeah.
Well, we go through them so fast that, like. Yeah, but I mean, you can get the Titanfall 2 ones for about $30.
But, like,
I'm in.
A Titan is basically you cosplaying as a robot, right?
Yeah.
It's a very big robot.
But you could just, like, get enough cardboard boxes and you're done.
That's basically it. I mean, yeah. I suppose.
It's cosplay supreme. It's very high level cosplay.
No, it's
someone
big.
Showed up to your party on a Titan, you'd be like, holy
cosplay
shit.
Cosplay supreme is my favourite potluck dish. No, but if I want to get my nice ogre, if I want to get Rosemary, that's going to cost me $300.
Actually, the Cosplay Supreme comes with Rosemary.
Right, Cosplay Supreme, the Rosemary has bananas chopped into it, and that's controversial.
Wow.
I can't remember what the question was.
It was serious games that need to be funnier, and funnier games that need to be really
all
fucking
of them
serious.
And everyone.
I literally can't. I've been trying. Can't think of an example of the latter. Probably tells you everything you need to know about something.
Next
or,
question.
Or does it? Thanks. Cole writes, Dear Creighton Crowbar, I suffer from the frequently discussed completionist mentality instilled upon me by video games. For that reason, when I found Creighton Crowbar, I decided to go back. Blah, 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 blah. I can't read. He can, I can't.
He can write. You don't know if he can read.
That's an excellent point. And it has shaken me to my very core.
Might be a lady.
Also, might be a lady. I've lost my thread. I'll start again. I don't know why this is so hard. I suffer from the frequently discussed completionist mentality when, in the fuck's sake, instilled upon me by video games. Why can't I read today? For that reason, when I found Crank and Crowbar and decided that I found much enjoyment in listening to the pod, I decided to go back and listen to the entirety of the show from episode 1. My journey through the backlog began on the 10th of September, and over the past 7 weeks, I have consumed around 250 hours, about 5 hours daily,
Jesus
of Crank
Christ.
And Crowbar. I still haven't figured out whether or not I'm proud of that fact, but I will say that I've enjoyed all those hours, and for that I thank all of you. Holy shit. For similar reasons, I've yet to play any of the Bioshock games. That's a fucking segue. because I never bought the first one and I refuse to play them out of chronological order. This has got me wondering, are there any games that you've ever played later installment of which has inspired you to go back and play the earlier games in the franchise? Thanks for entertaining me for something like 10 entire days. And keep up the great pod, Tom.
It must Mate, seem
hang on,
like...
No. The, oh, I've done that thing I do again. That was Cole. The next guy is Tom. Spoilers.
It must seem as if the world is rushing by him to listen to our podcast that fast. Like, Graham comes and Graham goes. People just vanish from the podcast so quickly.
I imagine it's like, you know that thing in like a time travel movie where someone relives all the events of the movie and the denouement where as they finally fix all of the different things that have gone wrong through the timeline. I imagine it's like that. But more disappointing.
C.S. Lewis has a really great description of the process of writing where he describes one of his characters taking a very quick time to do something. She does something very quickly and he describes himself writing half of the description and then getting up from his desk and going and making breakfast and doing all this stuff and then going back and writing the final conclusion of this very simple action. And I think that's basically what this person has just been describing, but as far as podcasts go.
I mean, it's a mad thing they've done, but it also, in some ways, it's a mad thing we've done. Mm-hmm. But it just took us a lot longer, so.
We're a mad slower.
Yeah, exactly.
And also just a question, I did, because I love System Shock 2 a lot, I did eventually, out of curiosity, go back and play System Shock 1, which I never played at the time, and I did not care for it. But I think that's largely, it's so different, it's really a different generation, a whole different time, and the interface is garbage. And I was quite excited about the remake, and then I played the demo of the remake, and it went wildly wrong for me in so many ways. Like, I literally couldn't attack enemies, like, my
moves
did not affect enemies, yeah.
Oh,
this is just the demo they released. But.
Okay. I've yet to play that. I should.
I haven't completely written off. I might try the final thing.
Well, Chris Avellone's on that game, right? So...
He's on everything.
Wrong.
Sure, it's...
I'm not entirely sure it's not my game. I haven't checked.
Yeah. Unfortunately, my completionist thing means that if... I haven't played the first game in a series, particularly if it's a narrative thing. I can't play it now.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
Like, and I said this a billion times over the last couple of years, but that's why I've never done a Witcher.
Well,
really?
Yeah.
It's not worth playing the earlier Witchers to play
no,
the later
Witchers.
No,
the earlier Witchers are all so bad.
But I almost finished the first Witcher once, and then I didn't. And now I've got unfinished business. And as a result, I will never play that
There's series. Something so psychically affirming to me, though, about the fact that it took them two massive games that they fucked up for the most part. And then they were like, oh, right, here we go. And they made the third game that's just brilliant. And they kind of finally pulled it out of the bag.
They put a 3 on it, therefore I can never play it.
Just think of it as called Wild Hunt. They didn't actually... Did they put a 3 on it? I think it
yes,
might just be called...
Yeah, yeah.
Is it called The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt?
It's a really big metal 3. Yeah.
Shit.
It's not a small 3. If it was like... You know, like Half-Life 2 is a tiny 2 at
the
top.
Witcher 3, wow.
A tiny 2? I could have dealt with a tiny 2. Can't deal with a big metal 3.
No.
I've always said that. My dad told me that. Pip, have you ever not played a game? Question. Answer?
Not really. I mean, like, there are some things that I know would benefit from me having maybe played one of the earlier ones, but I can't be arsed. And also there are some times when I've downloaded old, like, classic games and started to play them because, like, a new thing has come out. Like, I think when Thief came out, I started playing through the original.
Oh, shit.
But it just,
It's a good game.
It's a good game, but it's a hard game.
It was good in that it was interesting to see where a bunch of ideas came from, and it was... good in that, like, I think that the design in a lot of ways just held up. You know, it was more just the graphics and things that seemed creaky. But ultimately, I did still bounce off it eventually. I was kind of like, okay, well, I've sort of seen what it has to offer, and it doesn't feel like I'm missing out a lot on the experience because I'm not playing it in context. And so, you know, I kind of got a feel for it, but then ultimately there was nothing driving me forwards. So that is a recent example of it not really happening, I guess. And then there's just like that whole thing of, I think it's why I don't care about my Steam backlog either. It's, I don't feel any compulsion to play things that I'm not in the mood for. So.
Yeah, I kind of, I wish I had that. I keep having this compulsion to play through.
Never played the original Dota.
That's true. Wow. Narrative. I was stressed. It's always usually a narrative thing. Actually, I kind of have played the original Dota because there's parity, like, right?
Yeah. And Warcraft.
And I played a lot of Warcraft, so yeah, I could stitch it together into that one thing. But so recently I've had the temptation to play some of Dawn of War 2, which I played a little bit of, but there's so many expansions I missed. But for some reason, I got it stuck in my brain that I need to really replay Dawn of War 1 first. I was like, that's like 13 games, basically. So that's not going to happen now. And it's only because my stupid completionist brain will let me skip to the end. But
I played both thoroughly, and I can't remember the connection between the two. Like, you are the Blood Angels.
I'm sure there's no good reason.
I'm going to be very honest.
Blood Ravens, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, it's totally different.
I don't know what Dawn of War is.
It's Relic's Warhammer 40,000 strategy game.
Oh, it's like a, is it like Age of Empires?
No, it's, the first one's like a kind of,
it's like Company of Heroes.
It's like Company of Heroes.
Because the same company made that.
sort of, oh man, it's actually really hard to give you a reference point if you don't know Relic's.
Well, like Warcraft 3.
Dragon Alliance is not a terrible reference. Dragon Alliance is a decent reference to Dawn of War 2. Dawn of War 1's a bit broader scale, more like army level kind of fighting between.
That's vaguely interesting, actually.
It's good. Yeah, that's a great series.
Huh. Yeah, Dawn of War 1 is very much about like building bases. You place buildings and stuff, okay. And it's a proper RTS. And then Dawn of War 2, they decided that wasn't interesting, and they focused it on squads, and you had like 4 squads per mission.
Huh.
And one of them could be like a dreadnought or a tank or something, but the rest were usually squads, like, and they all had like 4 or 5 different abilities, and it would all be hotkeyed up, and it would be like, okay, I'm going to slam my rocket troops down and jetpack troops down in this place to melee these guys, and then move in my heavy troops to set up their artillery setting pointing this way, and then have my commander rush in because he's the tank and he's going to take all the damage. And
so that's fairly compelling.
Yeah, it was a really, really good mission that you then had to play 300 times. Like, the one way to use those Marines together was like beautiful and really satisfying and perfect. And then that was just how you played the missions, and there were a lot of fucking missions.
Cool. Good.
Tom writes.
That's you.
No, it's not him. There's more than one. We've established it. Great, he writes. I'm loving Civ 6, and he's written it with number 6 helping me. Especially the fact that it's closer to the super crunchy / complex Euro board games I've fallen in love with. During the great cardboard explosion of the last few years, Agricola, etc. And that, incidentally, is a sentence that you could not say to someone from, like, 1900.
It's amazingly evocative, isn't it?
Is, yeah.
The crunchy cardboard explosion of the last...
crunchy cardboard explosion. But OMG, yield icons, exclamation mark. So much clutter on the beautiful board, but essential for decision-making and planning. Can't live with them, can't live without them, 2 exclamation marks. What other time can you think of in games where you sacrifice the aesthetic for the purely pragmatic? Specifically, I mean, something that's optional. Thanks for reading, everybody. And he says, P.S. Chris, how's your Silver Tower models going? Did you get the Slaughter Priest on White Dwarf number 1? My poor attempt at attaching, he's attached a picture of one of his painted miniatures. And I'll tell you, they're going pretty well.
Hmm.
And he did say as an addendum, are you ever going to do a shut-up spin-off miniatures podcast? I'd listen for sure. Don't know about that at all, because, you know, Shut Up and Sit Down is its own distinct thing, but I know that
they have a podcast.
They do have a podcast. I know that Tom Senior and I have definitely talked about doing some kind of miniatures chat as either a pod special or something, but that's an entirely separate discussion about Tiny Plastic Men. On the subject of 4X games, and what other time can you think of in games where you sacrifice the aesthetic for the pragmatic?
So not only did I play Civ 6 with the yield icons on, I also it has a whole separate mode called strategic mode where instead of a 3D game, it's a 2D game, and they have separate art assets for every single thing in the game. And Jesus. It's just a completely different visual look. Mm. And it's a little bit clearer. And so I played in that exclusively, basically. I didn't look at the 3D thing. All the effort they put into those models was wasted on me.
Does it still do the cutscenes or the people interaction scenes?
When you, like, build a wonder?
So, no, like, you know when you interact with one of the other nations?
Oh, yeah, like diplomacy, it still, yeah, like, it's still the same.
Philip II's stupid
It would be great
face.
If they had, like, animated 2D cartoon characters.
I just wondered what their commitment
like Monkey
was.
Monkey Island 3. He's so good. And when I play CK2, CK2 has a really fantastic sort of like a naturalistic map mode where you can see mountains and rivers and plains and things. And I turn it off immediately to go for a map view which shows me duchies and I think specifically duchies. CK2 is a game about managing countries. And then on a level below that, it's a game about managing individual components of those countries. And so switching to a mode which shows me each of those individual components, such as, say, every component of France, which is a lot of components, that makes that game playable in a way that being able to appreciate the beautiful landscape of France would be incomprehensible.
Are you saying you need to be able to pass the duchy?
I absolutely need to be able to pass the duchy.
I don't quite get it. It sounds clever, but I don't get it.
Right. Yes,
that's a drugs thing.
Is it?
Rumbled by Pip.
I know this. Is it not a Missy Elliott song?
Pretty much,
pass
yeah.
Pass the duchy.
You know,
right?
Missy Elliott loves Crusader Kings too.
She loves Calcutta.
She will Crusader only play Kings as the too. Holy Roman
she
Empire. Loves,
she needs to be able to, and also, you know, I don't know if my pass, as in, you know, like, be able to understand, like,
yeah,
read.
No, yep. I mean, I get it. Like,
no,
I got
the
pun,
that
I just,
joke.
I wasn't
yeah, I
sure
it,
nah. of the,
no, yeah, it's
the
a,
joke, and then it came to me, it's a drugs thing.
Bant received.
Yes.
Next question.
No, anyone else with comments on this question, whatever it was?
I always turn off the HUD, for every, like, Sam Pity exploration-y game, because they're always so disgustingly ugly, and I want to see what the place looks like without, like, exclamation marks and, like, my life signs and, like, all of that nonsense all over the place. I just want to actually see the place that I'm in. And it's a source of great irritation that the last, like, time I played... Like, when I was playing No Man's Sky, like, back in August... you had to go into a menu system and then flick an option to disable the HUD and then go back into the game.
Yeah.
Like, that was such a problem for me, because it was like, no, just make this a thing that you can do from the keyboard.
Yeah.
And at least, like, Arc does that. You just press backspace and it's like,
oh, wait,
oh,
it turns
hooray.
It all off. That's great.
Like, the whole thing just disappears and you're just like, hooray, I'm no longer freezing to death and I can see the dinosaurs. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I am still freezing to death, but, you know, it's not telling me.
Something that along these lines came up during my last playthrough of Dishonored, which is an interesting problem, is I lost play that game with no UI whatsoever, and I appreciate that it gives you the option to switch everything off, including sort of mission icons and so on. However, it sort of fights the design in a way, because, you know, a lot of those sort of maze-like stealth environments hide really important things. Not arbitrary places, but, like, if you haven't played it once, you don't know where everything is. Switching off the indicator for what your objective actually is a bit of a risk, because you risk wandering aimlessly, which vastly, exponentially amps the difficulty of the game. Because, you know, stealth games are about getting from A to B, and... The challenge is normally structured and balanced against the idea that you'll be progressing roughly from A to B, not trying to figure out what the fuck B is. And so switching on a pretty ugly UI indicator that says you need to get here is kind of necessary in order to mitigate the challenge of the level, but also pretty inelegant. And you can, you know, I like having played through those games once, because then you know where everything is and you can switch off the UI indicators and just enjoy it. Without the frustration of going around in circles. But I feel like it's a sort of an unsolved problem in some ways. Like, because it feels like those UI indicators step in for your character's intuitive knowledge, or you can be generous from a fictional point of view and try and interpret it in different ways. Like, I don't know, Granny Rags in Dishonored tells you to go and steal something from the office of her physician. And you can think, oh, well, Corvo's lived in this city for a long time. Of course, he'd know where the office was. And therefore, there would be a little icon, a little arrow in the UI of his brain telling him where he's going. As you, as the player, don't have that information, so you need that arrow to tell you where it is. But I feel like there must be a better way of doing that. I love games that have actual practical directions given to you in real terms.
I was just thinking, like, it might be interesting to do something. It might be a bit heavy-handed, though, in that because it's a place that the person that you are playing as has been to before and would presumably have feelings of recognition towards it. Like, if you could do something with the colour palette or something so that the familiar route is warmer, maybe, somehow. Or, you know, obviously that's, you know, from an accessibility point, that's probably a nightmare. But, you know, so that you could still go off and do other things or explore different routes to the thing, but they would be routes that you wouldn't normally take because you'd just be going, like, the more direct route or the easiest route or the, you know, the more customary thing. So you could always maybe go back to it to find out the direction that you're supposed to be going because, you know.
Mafia 3 does something really interesting with waypoint navigation, which is, it's brilliant. It when you set a waypoint in your map, rather than attempting to model turn-by-turn navigation, which obviously doesn't exist in the time period that it's talking about, it will dynamically spawn street signs on the street.
What?
No, I know. I thought this is the most bullshit thing. It's amazing. It will dynamically spawn street signs at intersections to tell you which way to go.
That's amazing.
And it will do this until you reassign your map waypoint, at which point it will respawn new street signs, which are all dynamic physics objects that you can knock down and everything.
What?
Which is just such a beautiful touch because it means you can drive without looking at your mini map because you'll get to the end of the road and there'll be a sign saying go that way and you'll go, oh, well, sure, all right, I'm going left at this point.
Thanks, magic sign.
It's so good. It's brilliant.
I feel like the person who's given the problem of like, oh, like we can't show a route on your map because the GPS didn't exist at that point.
Knocked it out of the park.
Like, oh yeah, I got this. Like, oh, you want a realistic solution to this? I can totally solve
it's
this.
So good.
I'm just going to magically create the street.
It's the most Blendo shit in like a AAA game. Yeah. It's so good. Yeah, so that game, I guess, Mafia 3.
Jonathan writes, hello CNC. In a previous pod, you talked about the freedoms and limitations of first-person shooters in VR. Teleporting to move seems like a really big caveat for the genre. It made me think of an old EA property that could make a comeback. Magic Carpet. I don't know why I said it like that. In the old Magic Carpet games, you flew around in the 3D landscape on said carpet, casting spells. A carpet as a device for movement would work perfectly in VR. You could gesture to fly the carpet around and gesture to cast spells. The area of the carpet would give you some freedom to move around, perhaps to dodge attacks. But the limitations and the size of a carpet could fit within the real space you have to move around, which is a really good observation. But it is still funny. It's a bit like a cockpit. That is surprising. But you would have some freedom of movement, and looking over the edge of the carpet would be cool. What do you think? Also, he goes on to write, this would also work for a supervillain like Magneto, who flies around on a metal disc, which then got me thinking of another superhero, Superman. Do you think VR would work lying down to give the impression of flying? The trick here is we have no expectation of moving muscles to fly, unlike walking, so it would be natural feeling for the camera to move while body stays stationary. Personally, I think the best way to do traditional FPS in VR would be to stick with mouse and keyboard and instead use the headset to simulate a massive curved monitor.
Oh my God.
With real 3D depth. We're already used to the feeling of moving our view around with a mouse, and this would just be like an awesome 3D monitor. Keep on cybering those spaces. Jonathan.
Wow, this went totally...
This had a curve to it, but...
Jack, you were saying the magic carpet thing exists?
Yeah, it's a real VR game. I wish I could remember the actual name of it, but it's a really fantastic... student VR project, out of, I think, New York Game Studies. It's brilliant. It's a really great stylized, low poly, beautiful colored, VR simulator in which you're riding a magic carpet and, along a sort of flooded street, sort of Venice style meets Arabian Nights streets. and you're navigating by gesturing in various directions and trying to solve puzzles along the way by what you look at and by what you gesture towards. So I don't know. I think if you want to see a magic carpet in a VR game, that's a thing you can do.
There seems to be like a big delineation between games where they just will never move your view relative to the world and games where they will. And so, like, you know, Crytek's climbing game, which I think you play, Pip.
The Climb.
Yeah, that's
what it's actually called.
Yeah.
I didn't remember the name, but now
good
I
name.
Should have. It obviously moves your view in the world without moving your view in real life, right? You don't have to move, you don't actually climb in real space. You climb only in the virtual world.
No, but you can.
But it doesn't make you
sick.
Yeah,
you can move your head around and look around corners and things like that.
But then people like, the Budget Cuts guys and Valve are only really making games where they just never move your view without, they'll teleport you or you just move your head in real life.
Yeah, we do that at Crows as well. We try and keep the players still as much as possible.
And so, like, I gather that if you're inside a vehicle, then it's okay, because as long as the vehicle is only moving the way it would, the way real space would, then the fact that the outside world is not moving the way your head is fine. But I think with a carpet, that's so little visible geometry.
A lot of it's about the sort of vertical space around you. Like, if you think about cars and cockpits and things, it's about putting things not just on the floor around you, but sort of coming up around this space here to allow your eyes, when they're in this sort of natural forward resting state.
You're gesturing with your hands
in radio. Yeah. To have this point of reference sort of in front of your head that is stationary. I think a game that's interesting to bring up here is something like Hover Junkers, if any of you have played that.
Yeah, no.
Where, in a sense, Hover Junkers is kind of the magic carpet game, right? Except it's just got a sort of more of an architecture built around you, in that you're flying a sort of weird hovercraft, basically, that you can walk around and you can peer over the sides and all the stuff that the questioner was referring to.
On the subject of flying by lying down, there is at least one VR game that involves lying in a sort of wing rig that you then flap in to fly around. Like,
it's called Birder.
Birder.
Is it really called Birder?
Like B-Y-R-D-R or something, I think.
Oh, Birder.
Birder. That's very Somerset. Have you done it?
No, I haven't done it. I've seen people do it.
I'd like to do it. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, I'd try it.
I don't know. I think that a lot of weird stuff with VR requires a degree of vulnerability from the player in a way that we don't often see in video games, where we're just sitting at a desk or sitting on a couch or sitting on the floor. But to be essentially, there was a great line in the Prototype Vive, set that came out, that they sent out, that says something like, when wearing the Vive, you are functionally blind. And I think that to lie on the floor functionally blind, surrounded by cables and attached to an extremely high voltage computer, requires a degree of trust, or at least comfort, almost, that I don't know if is intuitive in the same way that other VR
experiences
are.
There's a pretty fixed problem with lying on the floor as a VR flight experience, in that presumably you'd have to lie on your face, and you have a big screen attached to your face.
Yeah, you have to have your neck up or something.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't seem particularly comfortable to me, nor particularly convincing, really, because even though your body has no frame of reference for flight, as the questioner suggests, you are still, you will know that in the real world you have a face full of carpet, put it that way.
The Birder thing is like a whole custom rig that you kind of lie in, and it's like a kind of, it supports, I think, like your body, but not your head.
Yeah.
And
it's more like
then
one
your
of those
arms.
Gyroscope things that you can get strapped into, isn't it? And you're sort of hovering, but, you know,
and
you
just sort
of scaffold of sorts.
Yeah. You like physically flap, but your arms are attached to like wing like things.
So good. Yeah. Such bullshit. I love it so much.
It'd be interesting to, like, I imagine you could have the most amazing transcendental VR experience if you were suddenly in a environment without gravity. Like, you know, like a plane doing a nosedive or something like that, where you could suddenly strap on a Vive and believe that you're genuinely flying through space or something. And you'd feel great, but that's probably hard to arrange.
Be playing Rez.
There are other things like that, though. There's an artist, I think I might have talked about this before, but called Nellie Ben-Hayoun, and she does a whole bunch of work with like NASA and stuff like that. But she created like this Soyuz rocket chair, and what it is it's kind of a normal armchair that's pitched at a slight angle to one side, and you sit in it and have like big headphones and a blindfold, and like the chair sort of shakes and plays you the noise of the rocket taking off, and it's a really convincing experience. Like, your body is kind of tricked into feeling like you're in a rocket, essentially, or what you think that would feel like. And then the culmination of it is you get to sort of the top of the experience, and there is a moment where your body is convinced, I guess, that it's weightless. And it's such a strange experience because you kind of know that you're sitting in a chair in an art gallery and there's like a bunch of people behind you, but you also are so convinced that you are weightless. And so that's stuff that was far before like the Vive and the Oculus Rift and stuff like that. But, you know, it's been far more convincing than any of the experiences that I've had in VR in terms of me feeling like I'm in a particular place, really. And so, yeah, with the carpet thing, the first thing that I thought was, but that's not how flying would feel. Like, you know, when you're lying face first, I think as a grown up, you're always kind of slightly surprised by how uncomfy it is, how quickly. And so, you know, you'd sort of have your chin in the carpet, you'd have your thing pushing your head back, but you'd also have pressure in your chest and your arms and no sort of sense of movement. And like, I think that kind of stuff would get uncomfy really quickly. And like, I'm not sure what the... I think that would interfere too much with the experience, because that is pressure that you are really aware of, like, quite quickly. Yeah. That's not a very helpful positive thing to end on, but sorry.
But it's not the last question.
Oh, good.
The last question is from Kane, and he writes, "Dear Dr. Crowbar, once a year or so I play through the UT, meaning Unreal Tournament, 2004 single-player campaign on Godlike or Inhuman difficulty. Partly I just think UT 2004 is a great shooter, and its single-player campaign is perfect for it. But it's also an excellent way to keep up my mind and reaction time sharp as I wither and age." It has been a long time since 2004. "Also, it's useful for charting the progression of my RSI, because with the extreme physical requirements of competing against godlike bots, you really feel the stiffness in your wrists. In fact, it was noticing my reduced UT 2004 performance that finally prompted me to seek long-needed physiotherapy. And now make sure to stretch properly after every 50 flak cannon kills. Do you folks have any ritual gaming calisthenics? Also, did you know that one of you 2004 bots is obviously Gordon Freeman, and that every match ends with a sassy dance pose? Regards, Kane."
I didn't know that. That's a very depressing way of like
measuring your decline as a human being.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a nice way of doing that, but it's a depressing way of playing games. Seeing games like slow chart into death.
Do you think it's like the opposite of those charts where, you know, like where people mark how tall their kids are on the wall?
How shit I am at U2004.
Like, I'm going to have like a Dota MMR chart on the wall.
Getting worse and worse.
Sadly declining with age.
Next to the height one. Once you top out at height, then you go down and...
But your wee bowling score is going to go right up. Oh,
that's that good stuff.
I don't have like a sort of like charting my own decline habit, but I do play Batman Arkham City. The one where you can play as Catwoman, and the one that has loads and loads of challenge rooms that you can play however you like. And I play as Catwoman in, I think, just the most basic like default challenge room. Or maybe, no, I think it's a DLC one actually, but it's the most basic one of the DLC ones. And it's called Arkham Manor, I think, and it's just like, or an armory maybe? And you're just in one room of manor. There's nothing interesting about it. The reason I play that one over all the others is it has very few special enemies. Like, the further you go into the other challenge rooms, the more like shields and tasers and weird exceptions they have to all the moves you can do. And so like, oh, that special move that you normally can do on people, it doesn't work on this guy because he's got that thing. And the like the complexity of that game is it's very simple and it's very rhythmic and very, the thing I enjoy about it is just like having to be completely present and spotting when someone's coming for you and pressing counter instead of attack, and every now and then pressing a special move button and killing some people. Sorry, not killing.
Permanently disabling some people. Bringing justice.
And so like, that's what I like about it. I don't want to have to stress about a whole bunch of other mechanics where I'm like, oh, I can't do any of my 9 normal moves. I have to do this other one. And it's just kind of, it's sort of a stress reliever, although it is in itself massively stressful. it's massively stressful unless I do it perfectly, in which case it's massively stress relieving. And so it's like a stress gambling game, where if you're stressed about something else, you can then gamble some of your stress on this game. And if you win, then all that stress will be gone. And if you lose, then you'll gain double stress.
It's not quite calisthenics, but every so often, every few months or so, I will go back to either Just Cause 2 or 3 and try and see what the most creative bullshit I can do in those games is, and without resorting to sort of previous tricks like driving cars down mountains or trying to tie airplanes to each other or something. And those games feel like such interesting potential simulations of physics cases or of like emergent gameplay cases, that it's really fun to go back to them sometimes and say, like, all right, I'm going to try and do something new. This time I'm going to try and do some real bullshit involving a train. Or I'm going to try and, like, absolutely fuck up some boats or something. I think that's an interesting way to keep yourself on top of understanding how emergent systems work in games like that, and trying to find new ways to push them to places you haven't seen them go before.
If I thought of it, I would probably load up Just Cause 3 just to fly around the island as like a stress reliever, because that's really just keeping yourself in the air. You can do it more or less indefinitely. There's no like hard limit on how long you can spend in the air, but there is a constant tally of how you're doing versus your friends in terms of longest air time, and there seems to be an effective upper limit. Like, you know, no one in my friends list has like 9 hours or anything. Right. It's like 13 minutes or something. And the challenge of doing that is, it's not too stressful. It's quite nice. It's just about like flow and it's very graceful when you do it.
Somewhere in this related series of themes, but one thing I found myself doing with Titanfall that I haven't done for a long time, probably since I took StarCraft seriously, StarCraft or Street Fighter, which I took seriously at the same time, so it's part of the same era, is I've started warming up physically before matches. Like I used to do this. So with Street Fighter, it was just running through repetitive motions on a stick. Just, you know, the muscle memory stuff, just making sure you knew it. And with StarCraft, it was the specific series of hotkeys that I knew I needed for a given match, trying to main a faction and trying to, and there's a sort of nerves that comes with loading into a solo ranked StarCraft game where you're like, very, very soon I'm going to need to queue these workers in this way and build this thing and hotkey this thing for later and so on and so on, and doing all those things. And Titanfall isn't as immediately nerve-wracking as either of those games, but the movement system is sophisticated enough. I was talking to Tom Senior about this today at work, actually, that most shooters require you to, like, be able to do sprinting most of the time, crouching some of the time, maybe prone situationally, and jump situationally, because most modern shooters discourage jumping, unless it's something like Quake, which isn't a modern shooter. So, whereas Titanfall requires you to constantly, with short intervals between each thing, chain jumps, sprint, crouch, which is functionally slide, jumps again, wall runs, which is jumping with a direction, and then optional moves like grapple hooks and speed boosts and phase shifts. And you're always sort of almost rhythmically moving all through all of those motions. So I found myself, as I load into those games, like just tapping those keys, just sort of getting my, you know, fingers and thumbs used to the idea of like, these are the patterns that you're about to have to follow. And I, you know, it's been a long time since the game has sort of got me that sort of pumped up for having to do a particular kind of physical set of dexterous moves. The other example would be something like Guitar Hero, which always requires you to kind of have certain things drilled into muscle memory. that's not really calisthenics so much as the thing that will probably one day require me to need calisthenics. But
I think because my history was mostly as a console gamer until the last few years, really. So all of the things that I was really good at as a kid and kind of got to that level of being able to do without, you know, without any break in it, or, you know, like there were levels of GoldenEye that I could just sort of speed run because I knew where everything was. I knew the exact point on a door that I needed to be aiming at as I rounded a corner to pick off the guy and which direction they would be facing. And my favorite level was train, because like at the end you had like a little square kind of trapdoor slash hatch kind of thing that you used to get out of the train, and you used your laser wristwatch to burn through all of the things. And I got to the point where I could just, like, zap each and every one of them individually, like, in a kind of really quick kind of thing, rather than wasting any... Like, I just really like not even needing to waste any laser power as I blasted my way through this thing, and then you just, you know, get the fuck out. And so those things, like, I would do over and over again just for, like, the comfort of doing them and being that familiar with them. And I used to go back and replay Ocarina of Time just because I knew all of the beats of it and where everything was. And they were wonderful and familiar. And even sort of on the was it the GameCube? Yeah, it will have been the GameCube. Like, Donkey Konga, I got really, really good at September, and I could just do that perfectly. And I found myself, like, I brought it up on YouTube the other day and was actually tapping away on the desk because I kind of still have that muscle memory. But the frustrating thing is they're all for things that I no longer own or that are no longer easily accessible or plugged in the right way. And so... And it's too much of a hassle to dig them all back out. So they feel sort of roped off in a way. And my history with PC gaming is far more recent. So I don't have like these things that I go back to again and again and again. And that I feel like I know in that same way. Because I guess when I was in more of an obsessive, I can only afford one game, or my brother can only afford one game and I can only afford to pay him to play it, you know, like for this amount of time, then I think that's when I would have been more likely to get into that obsessive frame of mind and play things over and over and over.
Mm.
So, and it's like, it's why I'm good at like levels of particular levels of like Mario Kart and stuff. It's because I've played them again and again and again. Whereas all of the new ones, I'm just like, boo, you know, I haven't mainlined this for 160 hours, have I? So yeah, but like the Donkey Konga one kind of surprised me, because like I say, when I pulled it up on YouTube, I just found myself like knowing where I clap and where, like, where it's one hand, okay, fine, and then this thing, and oh, I remember this, and yeah, so that was kind of satisfying.
Esports came along too late for your Donkey Konga career.
I know. It's really upsetting, isn't it?
Mm.
That would have been my thing.
Yeah.
But only the one song. And I can't play Guitar Hero because my fingers aren't wide enough. Like, aww. I can't reach the orange one, so I can only ever play it on easy because my hand gets hurty. Because, yeah, like, if you play it on easy or whatever, it strips out that fifth note.
Yeah, I think it does on normal as well.
Okay, but I can't play it beyond that because I can't move my hand quite right because my finger is just not quite there.
I can't play it beyond that because I'm bad. I think that orange one is bullshit. It's just garbage.
I think I might be bad also, but that's also a handy kind of, well, I'll never get good because it's physically impossible. They need like a babby kind of controller and then I'm okay.
I was so into those games for so long and I haven't touched them in years.
Mm.
That's a strange realization.
What, Guitar Hero?
Yeah, like those with the action games. They've passed out of the mode,
well, also, like, I think people went through that phase of being okay with so much plastic shit in their living room. And then after that, it's like, do I really need a drum kit that isn't a drum kit?
Mm. Yeah, no, I seriously did.
Mm.
I had a good time, but yeah. It's interesting those games have just sort of gone away, given how...
SingStar would still be good. That doesn't get in the way. It's just microphones.
Mm. Yeah, but you can't repeatedly learn a pattern with a microphone.
But you can learn a song.
That sounds too much fun for me.
If you can't codify it, it isn't fun.
Yeah. These are all things that induce the need for protection against RSI, as opposed to possibly, you know.
Yeah, but I think part of the question was about like this, like repeating things that are sort of that give you an idea of how you are in relation to them.
Yeah,
because I think I'd probably be horrified if I played some of them back. But that's why I was mentioning the Donkey Konga thing, because it was like, oh, actually, I've still retained at least some of this. Like, it isn't like a completely foreign experience to me at this point. And that was quite nice to know, because I didn't feel as sort of divorced from that aspect of my life.
Hmm. I do wonder how many midlife crises are going to be triggered by middle-aged people looking back at their Geometry Wars scores or Super Hexagon times or something and realizing that they're just simply not the people they used to be. There's some glittering spark of youth has been lost. You know, and then they buy a sports car, have an ill-conceived affair and ruin their lives.
I wonder if people used to go check their arcade scores and then just be devastated the day that they just couldn't climb their way back to the top.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that they did, but that's...
I mean, in some ways, games aren't quite old enough to have reliably confronted people with the reality of their immortality over and over.
Oh, it's coming,
again.
Though.
Like other forms of art, you know? It's on its way. It's coming.
It's on its way. You've got that to look forward to.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. When people look back on, you know, I don't know, everyone's gone to the rapture and think, oh, I remember that coming out.
I beat that in 4 seconds.
Yeah, I beat that so quickly. Fucking appreciated that shit.
Oh, what a great video game.
Well, we've reached mortality, so I
indeed,
guess it's
yeah.
not the end of
that's the heat death of the podcast, right there. Oh. That's all the questions we have time for. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can email us at questions@crowbar.com. You can discuss the episode on Discord.
Oh, is that the order that we're doing it this week?
I'm taking it off-piste, inspired by your example, Pip, but not being shamed by you right now.
Mm.
I've decided to do this in the order that my brain decides to do it in. And that is to now talk about Discord, where people can discuss the episode if they wish, or
Where's
any other
the link
manner
to that?
Of things. Well, the link will be in the show notes, won't it?
Where are the show notes?
On the website.
Oh, which is?
Quintcrowell.com.
Okay.
Guess what's in the sidebar?
Twitter?
No.
Us?
No. Yes, but no.
They are in there.
The logo?
No, Pip. It's a further link to Discord, just in case you missed it from the show notes.
But you said it was in the show notes. I thought you might have just meant in that general vicinity, like on the page,
no,
which
it
is.
That's,
well, that's doubling down, really, isn't it?
Well, it allows some information to be endemic to the entire site.
This
if you subscribe via RSS, then it's also in the show.
Oh.
Like the body text of the post will be all you receive, so...
Do we have a mailing list? Maybe we should send people the link
no,
to Discord that way.
List.
To access the transcript of this episode,
sign up to our live
by
journal.
By pressing autocomplete on your phone over and over again. Just accepting whatever nonsense comes out.
Are we on Twitter?
We are. As individuals and collectively.
Can't believe you didn't know this.
Collectively. It's at Crate and Crowbar. Individually, however, that's a different matter.
Great.
Where should we start?
Well, those? I don't know, Tom. Would you like to start?
I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
Pip,
I'm
if
also
you must.
At Pentadact, which is PENDACT.
No, you're not. Give Tom his handle back.
You always
back.
Said the funny thing about Viva Pinata.
I'm making a game called Hot Point.
Pip.
Yes?
Play the game. What is your...
At Philippa War.
There you go.
Which is PHILIPPAWARR. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yay.
Thanks.
Jack.
I'm on Twitter at Not Quite Real, which I don't need to spell, I hope. And you can also listen to the tabletop podcast I do with my friends. It's called Friends at the Table. And you can find it on Twitter at friends_table.
Who invited you to plug?
I plug... It's true.
We've all had quite a lot to drink.
I plug. Like iRobot, but you know, the logical conclusion of that.
In what way?
His tail would conclude in a plug.
A robot's tail is its plug?
I'm thinking Jesus of Chibi Robo.
Jesus fucking Christ. Let's move on.
I've just realised that when we introduced Jack, although we've had him on the podcast before, his credentials have changed since then.
Oh, God.
Not only the creator of Castles in the Sky, but also the writer
Jack,
of Dr. Langus.
Almost
from the
3 hours
Coast
into this. Things. Why not introduce yourself?
Who is this guy? How did he get in?
I'm Jack DeKeet. I work at a studio called Crows, Crows, Crows. I was the lead writer on a game called Dr. Langoskov, which is a game about a heist that goes brilliantly.
I'm glad that you use the shorter title.
Yeah, so well, you know, call it Tiger Game internally, which is ridiculous. But no, since the last podcast, which I was on with Graham, I've also been writing for Rock, Paper, Shotgun. So that's 2 years in the past. That's
Wow.
A long time ago.
Should we explain who Graham is?
He's the past.
He's dead to us now.
It was also different back then. I was good at Donkey Konga. Graham was still in the country.
I was 4 years old. The past.
And
it's
a
different country.
They do things differently there.
Covered in blizzard lizards.
Oh, no.
Did you say your Twitter name yet, Chris?
No, I didn't.
Chris, say your Twitter name.
The callbacks were coming out of the fucking walls.
They're coming from inside the car.
You're at Pentaduct.
No, we're not. I'm at Spartacus. No, I'm at C. Thurston. That's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
Validation.
That was the loudest thumbs up I've ever heard. Yeah.
I gave him the thumbs up and it made a sound.
I hope that's perceptible.
Maybe if you just add in a sound effect if it isn't. Like, boy, oi, 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 oi.
Boop.
No, that means someone's dead.
Oh, yeah, someone was killed. Who was it?
Oh,
it was
God.
Me. I think it
was this podcast.
Yeah.
It's almost midnight. We've been here for so long.
I was supposed to be done by 1:15.
Shall we thank them?
Yes.
Is that
who?
A thing
who
do we
thank?
The listeners.
Which
everybody.
Or everybody.
Hang on.
Everybody we thank.
Thanks.
Yeah, no.
But what are we thanking them for?
For listening to everybody.
No.
Well,
that's
well.
Not that sentence.
Oh.
It's.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Have a great day,
it's not
my
thanks
friend.
For listening to everybody.
But, I mean, it's both, isn't it, really?
No.
I mean, they're listening to all of us. They're not
in
just tuning one of us out.
This is why we've been here for 4 hours.
Oh, turn my microphone
Well, I didn't
off.
Tell you my thoughts about Superman or Magneto. So, you know, it could have
been...
Anyway,
longer. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Did you hear about these lizards?
No.
Hello.
Beep.
Beep. That's the noise Hitman makes when he kills someone.
That's boop.
Boop.
Beep is when he kills him overtly.
Yes.
So I got his unsilenced guns.
With a hammer or something.
Slightly more panicked.
That would be the most... I've just had the most amazing idea for a stealth game. Right? You are a person who has an array of weapons and gadgets and things to kill people with. But... You can't not involuntarily make the sound effect of the thing you're doing with your mouth. Bang!
And they're all silenced weapons.
Yeah, exactly.
You got a sort of bazooka that goes...
Exactly. But you're... I don't know why that would be good, but I said it.